Welcome to our exciting Saturday night surrounded by idiots episode. Folks, I want you to imagine for a moment being alive in a different time and place. Imagine being alive during the 1770s. Imagine being around, talking to, interacting with people with names like Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Revere. Imagine asking Franklin if he could scribble down some thoughts for his publications, and he said yes. Imagine being able to see these events as they took place. Now come back to the present time. Imagine how saddened and frightened you would be to see what happened to that dream. Now imagine that you are in the turn of the 20th century. Imagine that you know and talk to people with names like Ford, Edison, Tesla, and Einstein. Imagine talking to these people. Imagine learning from all of them. Imagine being able to have the opportunity to call them friend and associate. Imagine the moment when you realize that this brain trust, these minds, may be the designers of the protection that we seek from something that is in man's genetic coding, a fear so basic, so old, that it extends back to the mud dwellers millions of years ago and to within you and I. Ladies and gentlemen, if you can imagine that, then you know exactly what it is like to be in the chair that I'm sitting in tonight when I do this show. Using 21st century computers and various bits of excellent software, I bring you the men and women who are on the cutting edge of research, attempting to understand what our past can teach us deep inside ourselves, because we know what is approaching. Wormwood, the destroyer, the visitor, known as Planet X. Because you see,
in your face, all over.
Pardon me. Because you see, the tunnel has a light in it, and it's not a train, it's far, far worse. For the people we know as the sheeple, the happy, fat little townspeople that stumble from day to day concerned about the latest faux pas and dancing with the stars, who will win the game Monday night and which bill to pay this month, are about to be woken up. They're about to realize that they have been lied to and that the truth has been withheld from them. They're about to realize that they are not as prepared as they think, and that the FEMA camps are actually for them. For the wolf has come down from the mountain, and your fat little town is safe no longer. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an epic show for you tonight. We not only have one guest, but we have two guests. We not only have two guests, but we have three guests. So, what I would like to do is I would like to bring in our first guest, a gentleman by the name of Sheldon Day. Sheldon, how are you doing this evening?
Well, good evening, Bill. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. We are pleased to have you on. For our viewers that don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got into this Planet X maelstrom, let's call it.
Sure, that would be fine, Bill. Well, starting back in the early 90s, I started getting interested in all this UFO stuff and abductions and that, and I had been studying that up until maybe mid or late 2007, and then I had been listening to John Moore's show on Republic Broadcasting Network and also following some of Professor Jim McCanny's work, and they were talking about this Planet X thing, and it was really starting to interest me. And it was actually John Moore that brought me to the realization that there is indeed a Planet X object that is inbound at this time. And well, then John Moore also had John DiNardo on as a guest from time to time, and John put me in touch with John DiNardo, and we've become very close friends. And all my research is indicating that this is indeed what's happening. This explains a very bizarre behavior being exhibited by our government officials at this time. I mean, they're spending money like there's no tomorrow, and they've been setting up these seed storage vaults around the world, and NASA's been spending billions and billions of dollars on all these telescopes. And why do they have the South Pole telescope down in Antarctica, which is the coldest place on the planet and far, far away from major population centers? Well, the reason for that is because the former supervising astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory, Robert S. Harrington, who us Planet X researchers suspect was murdered, had put out information that Planet X was coming in to our solar system from the deep south. And, this is why they have the South Pole telescope down in Antarctica.
Okay. So, when did you get interested in this? When did you start doing your own show and really getting into this aspect of the science?
I would say it was about the middle or towards the end of 2009. I just keep listening to what John Moore was putting out on it. But John Moore says that Planet X is like four times the size of the Earth. That was actually disinformation put out for the public because they don't want people to know that this thing is much more massive. It's actually a brown dwarf star. And even Robert Harrington, the supervising astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory, had to feed some disinformation because otherwise he probably figured his life would have been threatened. Robert Harrington said that this thing will be coming in between the constellations of Scorpius and Sagittarius, which is roughly anywhere from, if you look at it, visualize the celestial sphere out there, coming in anywhere between right ascension 14 and 21 hours, and Harrington said roughly right ascension 18 hours is more like it. And here the elites have researchers looking out by the sun. They have them looking at other places. Well, the elites have hopelessly corrupted the sky. The sky viewing databases, so people stay confused as to where it's really coming in, but it's not Orion. They're trying to tell us it's Orion, but it's not the constellation of Orion.
Well, to simplify it for the for the average person, if you were, say, standing on the equator, and, you know, the Earth was maybe the size of your house, and you're standing on the equator, What direction would you be looking in? Would you be looking south? Would you be looking north?
Yeah, I believe at this time of the year, it's, I think, in the southeastern part of the sky, if memory serves correct. My friend Gilbert Erickson, he's another Planet X researcher. He's very good at explaining that better than I am.
Okay. In a few minutes, folks, we're going to bring in one of our other guests, and in the second hour, we're going to be joined by our friend Boris, who has been on a couple of times before. He is also a Planet X researcher. Have you heard about the effects that are going on with the sun? Have you heard? I've seen some news stories over the past few weeks that scientists are quote unquote puzzled about some of the effects that they're seeing with our sun, and I myself, I'm wondering if this might be related to the incoming Planet X, which the things that scientists are seeing is that the core of the sun is shrinking faster than they thought it was. There's a new type of solar particle that appears to be affecting the carbon-14 and pretty much all matter, and the sun is cooling and weakening all at the same time. Have you heard anything about that?
Oh, yes, I've heard a lot. First of all, they're under-reporting the daily ultraviolet readings that they're feeding the masses out there. It's actually maybe 3, 4, or 5 points higher than what they're telling us, because there's a breach in the Earth's magnetic field that was discovered, I think, in 2007 by NASA's fleet of Themis spacecraft. That magnetic hole around the Earth is 10 times more than what they previously thought.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the primary reason the elites are going underground is because of the solar scorching that they're fearful of. Because when Planet X comes in, it's going to cause the sun to flare out at some point. And another thing that they're not properly reporting is NASA's now expecting this solar max to occur in 2012 or 2013. I think the latest one they put out was 2013. Well, the solar max actually occurs every 11 and a half years when Jupiter is at its closest point to the sun. And that actually happened back in March of this year when Jupiter was at its closest point to the sun. So there's a lot of misinformation being put out there because they just don't want us to know how bad it's going to get, of course. And also in the movie Knowing, I believe that movie Knowing, where it shows the Earth being scorched at the end, that's that movie with Nicolas Cage.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the producers of that film are subtly trying to warn the public what they know is going to eventually happen here.
Does he want to come in now? All right. We have our other guest calling on the landline. Go ahead and hang up the phone. We have our one of our producers is on the phone with our second special guest.
Alright, I'm going to hang up now. He's going to get to you, John. Alright, bye.
This is the first time we've ever had two guests, folks. And we're going to see if we can bring in a hold on one moment while I attempt to do this. This is working out. I sound so professional when I do this, don't I? Okay, there we go. Let's see if this works. And we're waiting for the phone to ring, which of course it's not going to.
Did you want me to continue, Bill, while you work?
Yeah, go ahead. You go ahead and continue.
The person you have called at 973-263-8418.
Okay. Well, we'll have to try that again in a minute. Go ahead, and we'll continue trying to get our other guest on the show. Go ahead and continue, Sheldon. We were talking about the new particles that are coming from the sun, the fact that the core is shrinking faster than what the scientists have thought it would, and the cooling and weakening of the sun, and how Planet X may play into that. So you can go ahead and continue that while we attempt to continue to get our other guest.
Yeah, I'm suspecting, Bill, these are cover stories that the establishment is putting out because they don't want us to know how bad the sun is going to get at some point. You know, they show us these various apocalyptic scenarios on these motion picture films. I think it's because the elites themselves don't even know how bad things are going to get. They're using various avenues.
Okay, here we go. Is this John DiNardo?
Yes, speaking.
You are on the air with Sheldon Day and me, Bill Zamm. Welcome to Surrounded by Idiots.
Hi, Bill. It's a pleasure being with you and Sheldon.
Yes. Sheldon and I were just attempting to sound professional while we're on the air and getting you on the call as well. We were just talking about the observations of the sun that the astronomers have been having recently, where the core of the sun is shrinking faster than they thought. There's a new type of solar particle that appears to be mutating matter, and the sun is going into a cooling and weakening cycle. all the while Planet X is coming in. And we were getting Sheldon's thoughts on that, and you can chime in at any time.
Oh, okay. I had been following the latest developments with the sun, but not real closely. The sun has gone through, maybe 2 years ago, around 2009, the sun went through an extraordinary, record-breaking period of quietness, where the number of sunspots and flares was less than it had ever been practically throughout recorded history. And it was quite a worrisome situation. And I had theorized the only reason for this, you know, at a time when we were expecting the sun to become hyperactive, the only reason for this would be that Planet X and its incoming gang of comets were passing through close enough to Jupiter to cause Planet X and Jupiter to discharge to one another, and reduce the interaction between the normal interaction between Jupiter and the Sun.
And to further back up your assertion there, back in 2009, we had an amateur astronomer down in Australia observe two separate events where asteroids were smashing into Jupiter. So that corresponds to what John's talking about there.
Right, and it was around July 20th, actually on July 20th of 2009, that Australian amateur astronomer Anthony Wesley photographed a comet crashing into the southern hemisphere of Jupiter during that extraordinary period of solar quiescence. And this is an extraordinary event, to see a comet crashing into Jupiter. It's not like... it's something that can be, that comet crash into Jupiter can be associated with Planet X, very likely, because prior to that, they had rarely seen comets crashing into Jupiter. In fact, it was so unusual that the famous comet Shoemaker-Levy, its crash into Jupiter occurred back in the 90s, I believe, in the late 1990s. And that was an historic event. So,
I believe that was 1993 or 94, John.
Oh, okay, right. And, well, incidentally, too, that was Eugene Shoemaker's wife, Carolyn, who had sighted that comet crash. And just as an incidental point, many who have been following the subject believe that her husband, Dr. Eugene Shoemaker, a famed worldwide famous geologist, was murdered in an automobile accident in Australia, I believe. Eugene Shoemaker was giving speeches to many scientists around the world about the increasing number of comets that were coming into our solar system and menacing Earth. And the power elite, were doing everything they could to keep these scientists, highly credible people, quiet, so they would not stir up any awareness of this incoming comet X.
John, as a side note, we also suspect that the former supervising astronomer Robert S. Harrington was also murdered. He died of esophageal cancer. Well, some people out there would say, well, yeah, that's because he was a pipe smoker, but the plates that were supposed to be analyzed for blink comparison of Planet X were never got to be scrutinized by anybody, so we suspect he was murdered too.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, he was about to release his findings of a historic telescopic sighting that he had ordered to be taken from one of the U.S. Naval Observatory's southern locations in Black Birch, New Zealand. And he had written a paper. In fact, that paper is available on the Internet, from Dr. Robert S. Harrington, published in October of 1991, wherein he stated that all of his calculations as to the location of the origin of this gravitational pull on the outer planets, were so far correct that he had no reason to suspect that there was any difference in the actual location, and he was so certain that he was dispatching a telescope, turned out to be an 8-inch telescope, to that southern location in Black Birch, New Zealand, in the paper, he said that the sightings, telescopic sightings, would be done by blink comparison, which would indicate any movement and the direction of movement of that particular object. Sightings had to be made from a southern location because the planet is coming in from below the ecliptic plane, below our Earth.
Yeah, and he suspected that the angle of attack of it coming into the ecliptic would be roughly 40 or 60 degrees, John?
Around 40 degrees, and I believe he's correct. I mean, it shows, it's hard to estimate. We've heard different estimations of the angle at which this object is coming in below the ecliptic plane, that is that invisible disk in space on which all the planets rotate or revolve around the sun. And Dr. Harrington was probably correct when he said it was coming in at an angle of 40 degrees. It's 40 degrees would be sort of like if you could visualize a circular table and someone lying on the floor away from the table, off to the side, were to shoot a ball bearing with a slingshot up toward the underside of the table. You could visualize that the trajectory of that ball bearing would be, say, 40 degrees relative to the underside surface of that table. That table being likened to the ecliptic plane. The invisible disk in space on which all the planets revolve around the sun. So that explains why the sightings of this planet always have to have been made from the southern hemisphere, very close to the South Pole. In fact, the government of the United States secretly constructed a multi-million-dollar building, which is the infrared South Pole telescope, right in the harshest conditions imaginable on our planet, the South Pole. It's extremely difficult to build this observatory on the South Pole and to maintain it. But it had to be done there because that was their best viewing location. And that fact they went through extraordinary difficulties in erecting this South Pole telescope, that's another fact that points to all the evidence that adds to the knowledge that this planet is coming in from below the ecliptic plane, and it's approaching, and the government is so concerned and worried about it that they've kept the subject secret. They have murdered the chief astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., Dr. Robert S. Harrington, who had stated that he was about to reveal his analysis of those photographic plates after May and June of the year 1992. And then nothing happened, and as Sheldon said, the plates were just disappeared. They were somehow, well, maybe not disappeared, but the evidence of the photographic plates was kept absolutely secret ever since then, even though they should have been revealed, even though the man had died. Dr. Harrington had died of cancer in January of 1993. They never revealed the contents of those plates, so that proves that there was foul play involved.
So they just basically vanished.
Yes, I mean, those plates, whether they have them kept secret or whether they've destroyed them, it's more or less very much like the Kennedy assassination. So much evidence has been destroyed or kept secret because there was a murder involved.
Well, it even gets heavier than this, John, because the Vatican has also deployed telescopes like the one down here in Mount Graham in Arizona. And even Father Malachi Martin appeared on the Art Bell Show back in, I believe, the end of 97, or sometime in 97 or 98. And shortly after that interview, he had died from going down a flight of stairs.
We actually have the Father Malachi interview with Art Bell available right now. We can listen to that clip if you guys are ready for that.
Yeah.
Okay, hold on just a second. We're going to go ahead and play that.
knowing the future doesn't help one's peace of mind out. And I remember I had the dubious privilege of reading the text of the third secret of Fatima, which I must guard by oath from repeating, but it isn't pleasant.
I have a whole stack of faxes here asking me to ask you about that, and you obviously cannot speak of that.
Not factually, not word for word. I can't. I took a note. But it ain't pleasant. And the less you know about it, the better. Except that there is going to be a reckoning, and that nobody existing on the face of this earth will be exempt from knowing the power from on high. They will interpret it in different ways.
That stands to reason.
According to their
beliefs.
That's right, and their culture and their bias. And there will be people who, even faced with the certainty that there is a greater power above our heads, will say.
They will deny it. They will.
They'll reject it.
The scientists, for example, will find a scientific explanation for it.
They will. Remember the famous so-called Aurora Borealis in 1938?
Well, I certainly am aware of Aurora Borealis, but not one specific.
There was a specific one which they explained by saying Aurora Borealis, but it really wasn't that at all. They all agreed it wasn't Aurora Borealis. The only one who put his finger on it was Adolf Hitler.
And he
Great
said?
To say.
And he said what?
Well, he was in Berchtesgaden at the Wolf's Lair. That was his famous place when he for weekends with his cabinet. And Speer, Albert Speer, who was a member of his cabinet, his architect, tells us in his second book that that night they all stood on the esplanade of his villa in the Bavarian mountains, looking out to the east and seeing these extraordinary sights of light. And Hitler said, "Yeah, nun, now we have to shed blood. We didn't shed blood in taking the Tsar, we didn't shed blood in taking Czechoslovakia, but now we're going to shed blood."
And that, ladies and gentlemen, was Father Malachi on the Art Bell Show. I believe this was 14 years ago when he was on there. And I believe, John, you have some more information about this particular appearance and what happened to Father Malachi immediately after he was on the Art Bell Show and made these statements.
Well, I don't know if it was immediately. I think Malachi Martin died in 1999. But it was shortly after he had made the statements. I don't recall what was the date of these statements on the Art Bell Show. I know there were others around close to 1999. So it seems like it definitely was his death was a consequence of the statements he was making about this incoming celestial body. And I recall there was another famous statement that he made on Art Bell, which many of us have recorded also. Where,
I couldn't hear it that well. It sounded pretty muffled, but the one that me and you are thinking of was given in 97 or 98, and Malachi talked about an object out there that could be here in another 5, maybe another 10 years. Well, the 10 years has already passed, but just because the bus has not gotten here yet does not mean it doesn't exist.
Right, exactly. I mean, it was everybody was early in their predictions, but Malachi Martin had said to Art Bell on this other shorter clip that was not played here. He said that let me try to paraphrase what was said, because I recall it pretty clearly. Art Bell said to Malachi Martin, "Why is it that the Vatican has muscled into built an observatory and muscle their way into Mount Graham in Arizona, and I do mean muscle their way in. Why is it they built this observatory in Arizona?" And Malachi Martin said, "It's because the highest echelons of the Catholic Church know that something is approaching Earth in the next 5 to 10 years." He was a little early with his prediction, but nonetheless, the statement, the prediction itself was very worrisome and would have caused great panic. Coming from a man of high esteem, Maliki Martin had 3 doctoral degrees. He had been the advisor to several popes. And he was, again, anyone with high credibility, such as Maliki Martin, or an astronomer, a world-class astronomer, such as Dr. Robert S. Harrington, if they were to reveal such information that would cause the public to panic and cause the power elite to lose their manipulative control over the public, then the power elite would certainly be prone to murdering those people because they're credible. People like you and I, we're a little bit safer because we don't have that high credibility quotient that people like an advisor to a pope, Maliki Martin, would have, or one of the most esteemed astronomers in the world, Dr. Robert S. Harrington, would have. Those people get murdered easily. Or Dr. famed, worldwide famed geologists such as Dr. Eugene Shoemaker. All 3 of these people were pretty obvious that they were murdered.
Well, John, if you recall earlier this year, we also had the guy that runs the, I believe it's called the Minor Planet Center, where they catalog all these new comets and asteroids coming in, that Dr. Brian Marsden. They're trying to tell us that he died of natural causes, but they can induce death from remotely on people, too.
Oh, yeah, they have very advanced techniques for murdering people. As we know, they have. If you look at President Clinton, while Bill Clinton was president, there's a whole long litany of body counts, bodies that happened to deaths that occurred. It's called the Clinton body count, and many of them were killed from means such as, you know, medical conditions, etc. There was one man, James McDougal, who died in prison from some kind of an injection. He was about to testify against Bill Clinton, but the point is that they have sophisticated means of killing people.
They also have sophisticated means utilizing mind control on the Planet X researchers like Mark Hazelwood, who was one of the first ones out there openly talking about this. And, well, here he got transcendental meditation, and that allows the elites to get into people's minds when they get into those types of meditation.
Right. I'm a little bit reluctant to name names, but that's true. It seems that they're able to change. I've seen people change from being active researchers, very vocal researchers, who reach many people with their information that is desired to be kept secret by the power elite. And I've seen those personalities change. With one particular author, he was very vocal in warning the world about Planet X way back around up to the year 2002 or 2003, and then he suddenly became silent. And when asked to do interviews, he refused. Also, there's another astrophysicist, and I'm not going to name any names, but somebody who's been speaking about Planet X, and now he is very reluctant to talk about it. Then we have people whom we can name, such as you said, Brian Marsden, Dr. Brian Marsden, who was the head of the Smithsonian Planetary Institute. And he had speculated that, yes, we do have these comets coming into our solar system. Brian Marsden died. We don't know how he died. It's always a secret. They keep it secret from us. But this is at a crucial point now where some high-level people could be speaking, because Planet X is coming in. More and more people are finding out about it. And we have the death of 2 famous people. One was Dr. Brian Marsden, I think about a year ago. And the other was Dr. Thomas Van Flandert, who was an associate of the murdered Dr. Harrington. So, I mean, they would not hesitate to knock people off left and right, because just think about it. The power elite They survived and maintained their power and wealth by keeping people's minds controlled, manipulated, and keeping them in fear. When the people find out that there is a superhuman, supernatural force of a brown dwarf star, conservatively estimated to be at least 1,000 Earth masses, which would exert a gravitational force strong enough as it passes by Earth on its way toward its gravitational rendezvous with the Sun, this brown dwarf star would exert a force upon planet Earth temporarily during its passage that would molest the crustal surface of Earth and its electromagnetic field, but also terribly damage Earth in many ways. It would engulf Earth in a very powerful magnetic field that would actually cause destruction of the power grid as well as electronic equipment. I know from my work as a physics teacher and as an electrical engineer and electronic circuit designer, that when anything is engulfed in a very strong magnetic field, that field can actually produce electrical currents through a conductive object, what they call magnetically permeable object, such as Earth's partially metal mantle and Earth's mostly molten iron core. And it's like a microwave oven. We see that principle in effect every day when we use a microwave oven. You put some food in there that has moisture in it, and that food inside the chamber is bombarded with electromagnetic waves that heat up the food. So we know that electromagnetic waves do heat up.
Hey, John.
Some
of our viewers have been asking in the chat room what the time frame for these occurrences are, as far as we know right now.
Okay, well, it's very difficult, but we can use the Bible. Bible prophecy has shown to be accurate, even in the past. And we know the Bible tells us that there will definitely be 42 months of great tribulation, and that a man will rise to power to rule the entire world, and he will be called the Antichrist. In the Bible, he's called the Antichrist. We don't know who he is. It could be Barack Obama or someone else who rises to power. We know there is a great push for a one-world government. So the Bible, so far, its prophecies are turning out to be true, that there will be a one-world government.
It could even end up being the injured congresswoman down here in Tucson, Gabby Giffords, because somewhere in the Bible it talks about somebody that miraculously recovers from a gunshot wound to the head. And another researcher here in Tucson, he believes that it may end up being revealed that she's the Antichrist.
Well, that's possible, but the Bible does say it's a man. It calls it the Antichrist, the he. We don't know who it is, and I wouldn't even venture to speculate. I mean, some people would say it might be Obama because he has such charisma. Right? Actually, you know, this is getting off the subject a little bit, and I'll try to get back to the question real quickly, but anyone who is going to become the Antichrist to rule the world will do it under a very powerful demonic spirit. So even though we know that Obama is sort of a bumbler and a clown at this point, when that demonic spirit indwells a person, that person changes. He's got the shell of the ability, the shell of the Antichrist spirit. And I don't want to suggest that it is Obama, but he certainly has that narcissistic personality, that grandeur, that megalomaniac, maniacal personality. So when he's indwelled by a demonic spirit, he'll change. So anyway, we know some Antichrist is now rising to power. The power elite are struggling desperately to get a one-world government, and they're going to do it by trying to create such a conflict that the nations will be in a shambles after this war, and they will the people will cry out for world peace, and that's how they will institute this one world government under a pretended one world peaceful leader. Okay, so getting back to the question, how much time do we have? This Antichrist will rule for 3.5 years during a period of great tribulation. So there will be wars while this tribulation is going on. Well, there'll be wars, and then the Antichrist will take over. All I can say is we've got more than 3.5 years before we reach what may well be the very total destruction of all civilizations on Earth. We got more than 3.5 years according to the Bible. Now, where's Planet X right now? It's hard to tell, but I believe many people are now seeing that it could very well be up around Saturn, because we have storms occurring right now in the northern hemisphere of Saturn. How could this happen? Well, if you could try to visualize that circular table that I just described before, and that ball bearing being fired from below the table, off to the side, coming up, it penetrates the underside of the table, that's the ecliptic plane, not in the center, but out near Jupiter. Historically, ancient historians have told us that when this planet came through in the past, 36.5 centuries ago, it came through between the orbital path of Jupiter and the orbital path of the asteroid belt. So if this thing is coming up through those between the asteroid belt, which is beyond Mars, and Jupiter, then it penetrates. It's going to go above the ecliptic plane as it penetrates the ecliptic plane, but continue going further out toward the edge of that table. But it would be over the top of the table now instead of underneath, and that would explain why you have this huge, unprecedented storm on Saturn right now. But in the process, it's making a big loop around. It's being pulled in by the sun. Remember, the sun is what drew it in the first place, the gravitational force of the sun. And that's pulling it around to make a big loop. So that loop is going to be kind of slow, because now it's decelerating. It's slowing down because the sun has overshot the sun. The sun is trying to pull it back again. And so it has to go from one direction. It has to change directions and make a big U-turn. And you know, as a visual example, if you ever had to make a sharp U-turn on a highway after going like 60 miles an hour, you'd have to slow that vehicle down quite a bit to make that U-turn. Well, that's sort of what happens with this planet. It could be like a couple years before it actually starts passing over the top of Earth's orbital path, and that's when we're going to really experience the very close proximity and the devastating gravitational and magnetic effects of this planet here on Earth.
Let me ask you a question, John. On the screen right now for the viewers, I have some of the two sun images that people have been taking. Is this part of that system?
It could well be. You know, if I've seen a number of them, and there's just too many of those two sun images that we have seen over the past year to attribute it to some kind of mirage or falsehood. I think it's just by the sheer number and the diversity coming from different nations, these photographs of two suns indicate that it is true. Now, this might explain it. This is something that comes to mind as to how we could explain it. If Planet X were, like, for example, I'm looking out my bedroom window now, facing the front of my house, and I'm looking out and there's a street light right in front of my house. If I were to hold an orange in my outstretched hand, right in my line of sight of that lamp looking out my window, it would appear, let's say that orange were the sun, and the street light 65, 70 feet out in front of my house is in line with that orange, it would appear that streetlight is right next to the orange, wouldn't it? So it might appear that Planet X is right next to the sun, even though its distance from the sun is much farther. So we could be looking out toward it, its position far out into the solar system. However, what is going to happen if you're on this on a revolving turntable like we are on planet Earth revolving around the sun? What will happen is, as the months go by and you go from one season to another, what's going to happen is that you'll be looking at the sun. Now rotate your arm. You've got that outstretched orange in your hand, in your outstretched hand. I'm sorry, you've got that orange in your outstretched arm. And as you rotate the orange around, the sun, or that street lamp, is no longer, I'm using the wrong term, Planet X, or that street lamp, is no longer in your line of sight with the orange, but it's off to the side. So if my theory is correct, it doesn't seem like it would be correct, as we go through the seasons, that second sun will no longer be in line, or that Planet X object will no longer be in line with the sun. Can you visualize that?
Yes, but it would be moving.
Right, because we are rotating around the sun.
Right.
And my arm is still rotating with me, and that orange is still rotating. Now I've turned around with my back to the streetlight now, and I'm still looking at that. I'm looking toward the inside of my house, and, you know, looking at that orange in my outstretched arm, which is the sun. And the streetlight is to my back, so I don't know. I mean, I don't think that object could not actually be near the sun, because if it were, imagine the electrical excitations that would occur. I mean, we know that this is where the peak of the disasters are going to occur, when this object loops over the top of the sun and gets so close that it causes the sun to put out deadly coronal mass ejections and flares, so great, X-rays, all kinds of arcing, it's what they call sprites. All kinds of electrical activity that will cause solar scorching on Earth, that will knock out the power grids, likely scorch all life on Earth, on the surface of the Earth. So,
and John?
I'm sure that object is not actually near the sun.
Yeah,
if it were,
a certain distance
we would
away.
Be dead by now.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to happen.
Can I cut in there, John?
Sure.
Well, I'd like to also point out that our solar system has been undergoing violent climate change for many years now. NASA's been spending billions of dollars on all these probes to go study Mars. That's probably because of the climate change going on at Mars. And as for the date thing, when is this thing going to get here? That's one of the most popular asked questions. Well, according to John Moore, one of his highly classified sources said back at the end of 2009, the continuity of government contingency planning had up until that time to finalize preparations with their underground shelters for this event. Any time after that is just privileged time to be alive, and they'll continue to prepare up until the last minute, even though they're already fully prepared. And what me and John here think is going on is why this thing hasn't gotten here yet is because God is actually slowing the inbound progress of this dwarf star down to give us humanity a little more time to wake up. Mosey, go ahead, John.
It makes sense, though, when you look at that. I liken, if you can visualize, the trajectory of this comet. I have a surmise from studying it that the trajectory is sort of like if you were to take a cucumber, look at the outline of a cucumber. That might be a good representation of the trajectory of this object. It has always been stated for many years by all researchers that it's on a cometary orbit. We know from ancient history that it's on a long cometary orbit, which is elliptical, and that would be like the outline of a cucumber. And if you would hold that cucumber at a very acute angle to, say, the underside of a dish, okay? That dish, representing that invisible disk in space on which all the planets revolve around the sun, and the cucumber represent its outline representing the cometary elliptical trajectory of Planet X. you could see that when the cucumber, if it were to penetrate through the bottom of the dish, its curvature at the very end would be the loop around that we're talking about, where it would go through the orbital path between the asteroid belt and Jupiter, and then continue traveling out further toward the outer section of the dish, or the ecliptic plane, and then, thus they would take it right basically over the Saturn's orbital ring or orbital path, and it would have to slow down because it's making a big loop around. You see, another comparison would be someone running toward you, and you're pulling that person. Okay, let's take a fish. You're fishing, okay, and you're reeling in this huge fish, and you're exerting a pulling force on the fish, and you're causing that fish to accelerate because you're exerting this pulling force along the line, the fish line itself. Well, that line would represent the trajectory, the gravitational pulling line of the sun pulling Planet X, reeling that big fish, Planet X, in toward the sun, the fisherman being the sun. But as the fish gets over the fisherman's head, what happens? The fisherman is no longer pulling the fish toward him. The fish is actually overshooting the fisherman, and now the fisherman has to pull back on the line, causing that fish to decelerate and loop around, and that's exactly what's happening with this planet. So it's going to take longer than we expected for it to loop around and make that big U-turn over the orbital paths of the inner planets, first over the orbital path of Jupiter, then the asteroid belt, then over the orbital path of Mars, then over the orbital path of Earth, and so on until it loops over the top of the sun and is catapulted back down through the ecliptic plane, below the ecliptic plane, and back out into space for another long 36 and a half century journey.
I actually have a cometary orbit on the screen for the viewers to see.
Well, right, John, now I'd also like to add that back to the issue of the solar storms that we know are coming soon. Not only in the movie Knowing with Nicolas Cage are the producers of the movie trying to subtly warn the public without fully telling us, because they have a code of ethics whereby, you know, there's at least they told us so, even though they're not telling us the full truth. But we also have Jesse Ventura, former Minnesota governor, and his film crew. He aired a two-season thing called what are those
Apocalypse called? 2012.
Yeah, the specific episode he aired was called Apocalypse 2012. It aired on True TV, and Jesse Ventura and his film crew went to into the bowels of Cheyenne Mountain and also visited the Denver airport, whereby they also talked about these solar storms that will be coming, but they never get to the root of what's going to cause the solar storms. I suspect Jesse Ventura is part of the establishment, but he is trying to leak it out to us without getting killed.
Yeah, he's done a good job of bringing out this crucial information. So, when people say when, I say it's coming soon. And here's the thing about it. It's not like you would turn on a light bulb, and when the light bulb is off, everything is fine, and as soon as it's switched on, you have total devastation. No, it's more like a dimmer switch on a light. The light is gradually getting brighter. It's going from a state of a dim state to a gradually brighter. Day by day, it's getting brighter and brighter. Well, this object and the catastrophic events on Earth are gradually increasing day by day. The flooding is getting worse. The wind storms are getting worse, more frequent and more severe. The earthquakes becoming more frequent and more severe gradually, day by day. So we're in a period where we have to prepare, and the news is even worse than waiting for that day in total comfort. We're in danger and in disaster mode right now. Many people have suffered. Many people have died so far. I've been keeping track of the disasters by videotaping severe weather reports from the Weather Channel, and I've got like 250 hours of nothing but severe weather reports from the Weather Channel. I can recount some of the disasters really quickly to show you that this thing is ramping up, and if you watch what's happening. For example, we had, do you know that there was snow in Jerusalem a couple of years ago? It was in the springtime, snow in Jerusalem. We've had epic flooding in various many parts of the U.S., in the upper Midwest along the Mississippi. Even in what's now drought-stricken Texas, we had horrific floods several years back. I've got that all on videotape. Terrible floods in Washington State, even Arizona. You got a dry state like Arizona, New Mexico. Flooding occurring frequently. California, flooding. Go ahead, Sheldon.
Well, John, I wanted to throw in what the historians of the ancient Mesopotamian text stated, that when this celestial object came in, there were massive inundations of flooding around the planet, and that's what we've been seeing. And they've also been under, you know, as decade by decade goes by, the earthquakes are getting a lot stronger, and they've become so strong that now they're even under-reporting them by one full magnitude number.
Right, right. Zachariah Sitchin, you're referring to Zachariah Sitchin in his landmark book, The Twelfth Planet, where he does talk about this Planet X, and he uses the name Nibiru, which is the name that was given to this this brown dwarf star when it came in two or three orbits ago, many thousands of years ago. And
That would have been Atlantis, wouldn't it?
Right. Well, let's see now. If we go back, Atlantis would be around, most researchers believe, I think some of the best researchers, such as the Horizon Project, believe that the sinking of Atlantis was around 9,000 B.C. Now, we know that one orbital period of Planet X, or Nibiru, is 36 and a half centuries. So if you go back 36 and a half centuries times three orbits, you land on around 9,000 B.C., and that's when this brown dwarf star caused the sinking of Atlantis. Then that would have been three orbits ago. Two orbits ago would have been the great flood of Noah's day. And the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, and that's when the great flooding is recorded by the historians to have been one of the first signs of disaster.
But John, the Bible says that then this go around the Planet X, we won't be destroyed by flooding. It'll be incineration this time, which we're attending this.
Right, that's what the Bible says in 2 Peter chapter 3, that the world will be destroyed by fire. However, you know, leading up to it, we've got a whole variety of cataclysms, one of which is flooding, because it always does cause flooding. And of course,
there won't be a lot of flooding, but the majority will be solar storm.
Well, the majority will be what?
Well, there will still be a lot of flooding, but the majority of this current event coming up will be incineration.
Right. See, it's a matter of it's a process or a progression that occurs as the planet gets closer. And I can show you the documentation. You know, the National Weather Service maps. Weather maps are very convincing, and it's clear documentation on those weather maps that what is happening is this incoming brown dwarf star is causing the jet stream to become severely undulated. Now, the jet stream historically has been rather horizontal. It's the flow of air along the northern hemisphere, which goes from west to east. And there's also a jet stream in the southern hemisphere, but we'll just deal with the jet stream in the northern hemisphere because that's the one that we see on television on the Weather Channel. The jet stream, you might liken it to the U.S.-Canadian border, which is essentially the borderline is rather horizontal with a little bit of a concave dip to it. And that was historically what the jet stream pattern used to be, and that would result in very predictable temperatures, moderate temperatures, through the 50s and 60s and 1970s and 80s. But now what we've seen ever since over the past 10 or 12 years and getting worse is a jet stream that is no longer approximates the shape of the United States-Canadian border, but now looks like a capital W in script. You can visualize a capital W superimposed on the map of the United States with the peaks of the W extending northward into Canada and the troughs of the W extending downward into Mexico and into the Gulf of Mexico. And furthermore, this W sort of rolls across the United States from the Pacific Ocean from west to east. So it's like a rolling, horizontally rolling W. Now what that causes when on the vertical excursions of the W, that is the vertex, the inner vertex, the leading edge of that jet stream, when it crosses, say, let's say it crosses the Midwestern United States around the Mississippi River, all the areas around there are going to be subject to severe weather conditions because what you have is inside the trough of the W is cold air being pulled down from Canada. And in the vertex of the W, in the center, warm air is sucked up from the Gulf of Mexico. So now you have warm, moist air sucked up to clash directly with cold air being pulled down from Canada. And when it's like cold water being poured into a hot, sizzling frying pan, you get all kinds of spattering and violent reactions. Warm air is sucked, drawn up, collides with the cold air. It, because it's warm, the cold air drops down, it's much more dense. The warm air rises very high in the atmosphere where it's instantly frozen, and you get hailstones. This is, in many cases, I've got this videotape from the Weather Channel. Hailstones the size of baseballs and even the size of softballs. And people get killed by hailstones that large. That's been happening. And it never used to happen before. Now it happens quite often. I've seen cars demolished on the Weather Channel from these huge hailstones. Houses, too. Roofs battered. And, you know, speaking about survival, we need to talk about the survival. We probably don't have the time now. But next time we get on, we should talk about how to protect your roof from hailstones that would literally smash your shingles and cut into your roof, into the plywood sheathing, and compromise the integrity of your house so that the rain would come in and your house would be severely damaged. We got to thinking about ways to put some kind of a copper, something on the roof, or some kind of a screen, like a chicken wire screen over the top of it that would break the fall, the impact of these hailstones, so they would not damage the roof.
Go ahead, Sheldon.
Well, I was going to interject by going back to the flooding that we're witnessing. There's these places over in Asia that are actually starting to relocate their populations because of the flooding. I just reading that over in Bangkok in Thailand, the capital is considering moving to higher ground right now.
Wow, that's an entire city. Whole areas of the country are moving. And you know, the Weather Channel reported that Honda, if you own a Honda, it's going to be very difficult to get parts for that Honda, because a lot of the manufacturing plants are in that area of Thailand that was stricken with great floods.
Well, this is also going on in Malaysia and the Philippines and Indonesia.
That whole area appears to be sinking at this point.
Yeah, you're right. There's a tectonic plate. I think Nancy Leader was talking about that in some of her newsletters about the tectonic plates out in the in Asia that are beginning to buckle. And as a result, as you say, Bill, land masses are beginning to sink.
Mm-hmm.
And I just read a report that, another report, that we're having seabeds shifting now and out in their depth, buckling.
Well, this is another thing a lot of people aren't aware of when it comes to what happened out there in the Gulf of Mexico with the so-called BP oil spill. That was not corporate stupidity. What actually happened was, John has a friend, he'll share this with you here in a second, but the elites knew that Planet X was going to cause these Earth changes to get more severe, so they decided to take advantage of the fact that it is getting closer and tap into an undersea oil volcano in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, they've discovered that they're getting a lot more oil out of that undersea oil volcano than they anticipated, so they're having to spray Corexit to conceal all the fissures that are opened up on the seabed from them tapping into that volcano, and there was a whistleblower that decided to leak it out on mainstream that the actual point of rupture is a lot bigger in a different location, and he ended up getting murdered. He died in his bathtub, his hot tub at home. His name was Matthew Simmons.
Right, Matthew Simmons. You could see that interview that Matthew Simmons gave on the Terrence Radigan, I think his first name is Terrence, on Fox News,
mm-hmm.
Radigan show.
Yep.
During the days where we were shown that undersea webcam of the so-called leaking BP oil well at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, during those days, Matthew Simmons, a high-level oil industry executive and a man who would be highly credible again. They, when a highly credible person starts to become a whistleblower, that's when they tend to execute people like that. Especially since he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and those people are pretty much like the Freemasons, basically Freemasons, where if you are, you're sworn to secrecy, and if you begin to reveal anything about your activities, well, he wasn't talking about Freemason activities, but he was blowing the whistle on BP. And BP, somehow, a couple days after his interview, he, as Sheldon said, he died in his hot tub. Now, during that interview, what he said was that is a phony plume of oil coming up that they're showing on the webcam. That thing is phony. He said, look, there's a white fish swimming through that oil plume, that rising oil plume. That thing has no pressure. There's practically nothing. He says the real leak is lying so many miles off in fissures and cracks in the seabed. And accusation, that allegation is confirmed by someone else who was on Keith Olbermann. When Keith Olbermann was a famous MSNBC commentator, Keith Olbermann showed the clip from a man, an executive, someone, an expert, speaking before Congress, stating that the reason why BP promptly put down that highly toxic Corexit all over the Gulf of Mexico was to not to break up the oil, but to simply mask the seabed so that people could not see what's really going on at the bottom of the sea in the Gulf of Mexico.
And all these people that have been getting sick from this incident, all these people getting sick from this incident, it's just collateral damage is what it is, like the chemtrail spray. And the real reason they're doing that is to shield us from the radiation that this brown dwarf star is emitting as it comes in. So they always have all these cover stories in place for the alternative research community, the so-called truth movement. That way, nobody ever knows what's going on.
Yeah, you're right. That's another, a whole different story, but that's very close to, in parallel to what we're talking about here, is what you're saying is, and I've suspected this, I'm one of the few people who really believed, I know the chemtrails are harming us, and I believe that they're getting some, the power elite are getting some mileage out of injuring the population. We know that's their plan, to decimate the population, debilitate and decimate the population, so that they'll have a weakened rebellion or a lesser rebellion against them. However,
John,
I think the main reason is that, as Sheldon said, that what they're trying to do is create a polymer bubble. And they've been doing it ever since the mid-90s when Comet Hale-Bopp, the precursor to Planet X, came into our solar system. It was at a time, the chemtrails started in the mid-1990s, and they've been going on ever since because of this incoming body, I believe. Again, this is an educated theory, not proven
fact. The passage of that Comet Hale-Bopp actually affected Earth weather for 6 or 7 years, but the fairy tale science coming out of NASA is that, oh, these comets are dirty, icy little snowballs that have no effect on the solar system, but the opposite is actually true. And passing comets actually cause what's cause and effect known as action at a distance. This is a well-known term in the the astronomical community.
The study of physics, right. in the study of physics.
Planet X doesn't have to collide with Earth. It can create incredible cataclysms at a distance, even though it may become as close as 15 million miles. Hey, John, can you tell the audience about what your friend Mark had told you about the Gulf of Mexico? That's really important.
Yeah.
Your friend Mark.
It's got to be at least 5 or 6 years ago, long before anybody ever heard, long before this BP oil spill, which occurred last year. About 5 years ago, my friend Mark told me he has a friend who is a geologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And about 5 or 6 years ago, he said that his friend expects the land, he and the people in his organization expect land masses to arise out of the Gulf of Mexico. And also, in the same statement, they are anticipating fabulous oil drilling opportunities in the Gulf of Mexico. Now, those two seem like unrelated comments. Land masses are rising out of the Gulf of Mexico and fabulous oil drilling opportunities arising in the Gulf of Mexico. But they're really related. If you stop and think about oil bursting up from the below the mantle, from the mantle of the Earth, which is below the lithospheric crust of the Earth, which comprises the seabed of the Gulf of Mexico. If you visualize oil being pushed up in bulges, it's very profitable to tap into that oil that's now very close to the surface and has been detected by the high technology satellites that they have viewing, where they can view into the Earth, the surface of the Earth, and even below the Earth. I believe it's called torsional vortex imaging.
Well,
so
earlier
they're able to explore for oil because, remember, they use our tax money to make money. So they use our tax money to be able to find where oil deposits are so the oil corporations can get even richer. And that's why they went into the Gulf of Mexico to see these, but it's tapped into the oil at the same time. They found out, hey, look, this seabed is ready to burst upward. So there you go. There are two very seemingly unlikely unrelated comments that indeed are closely related. Go ahead, Sheldon.
The viewers are seeing right now John's email about the land masses in the Gulf of Mexico rising, so they can read along while you guys are talking about that subject. It was from August 22nd of 2010, John.
Oh, you got the article. Okay, yeah, I had it in my mail folder, and I'm glad you got a hold of it.
Yeah, it's right up here on the computer screen. I'll leave it up on here while you guys are talking about it. It mentions the coast from Mexico to Florida, Cuba, Haiti, Hispaniola, and Puerto Rico.
Yeah, right. I mean, and there's many other indications, too, because some people...
Well, let me interject on the movie Knowing. We have events played out in that movie. And in that movie, it shows an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. That movie was put out before that incident in the Gulf ever happened. And then towards the end of the movie, they show us the solar scorching. So you got to wonder, is this that next big event? Is the solar scorching coming? And, you know, you talked about how they use this technology to peer into the Earth. Well, earlier this year, back in March, Lyndon LaRouche put out an action alert that the Obama administration was shutting down these earthquake sensing satellites. So, you know, they know that these earth changes are going to get worse, and they may not even want to hire echelons at NASA to know about it.
That's a very good point. I forgot all about that LaRouche report. That's true, and we've got to verify that, check into that, and find out why the government has shut down earthquake sensing satellites. And of course, they don't shut it down for themselves. They continue to use those facilities. They just bar public access to that information, just as they did with the Hubble telescope and with the infrared astronomical satellite, where they had made observations in space, and then they claimed that, well, that's it. This Hubble telescope is no longer operative, so cooperating nations and the public can no longer get information while they in the elite, small elite circles continue to get information and keep it secret, keep it concealed from the rest of the public. Well, that's what they're doing here, too. They're monitoring the earthquakes, but they're not telling us about it.
Well, that's another thing. They've been hauling tons and tons of stuff up to the space station, and I used to be a big fan of the space shuttle program when I was younger, but me and John, we suspect now what's really going on is that they've been watching this dwarf star coming in from the space station, and the space station may even be an orbiting weapons platform to fire at this entourage of space rocks that accompany Planet X as it comes in. According to one of John Moore's sources, the debris field of rocks is at least a quarter of a million miles on either side of it. And here's something I also uncovered. Nobody else in the Planet X community has talked about this, but they're moving all these agencies out to higher ground in Colorado, like the CIA moved out there, and now I just found out Aero Electronics and Pullman Camping have moved out there, and then you got the Denver Airport.
Yep.
And they're still working on that airport 17 or 19 years after ground was broken. But what I uncovered was a NASA contract whereby they awarded this contract to a Prudential subsidiary to start relocating their own people, and that the NASA contract is three times more than the CIA's contract where, the CIA was going to move out to Denver. So, and then a few months ago, we had the administrator of NASA, Charles Bolden, warn his employees to always be prepared for natural disasters. So you connect all these dots together, and it really makes sense that they know something big is coming.
Well, you can find that video on YouTube. All you have to do is search for the NASA emergency employees video. And did you guys know when they were building that airport in Denver? And I found this out just earlier this week when we had Lucas on, that they originally built the buildings for that airport, and oops, they were all in the wrong spot, so they buried all of them. They buried all of the buildings they had built and built another airport over the top of that. And also,
well, interestingly enough, at the end of the True TV episode that Jesse Ventura did, him and Jay Widener were riding in a car outside the perimeter of that airport, and it showed these long rectangular concrete tunnels. And, Ventura asked Jay Widener, what are they doing with those? And Jay Widener said, they're getting ready for the end of the world.
Yeah, I remember that episode. And also, out at that airport, I think it's up to over 100 aircraft now. The windshields on them are shattering from low-level sound.
Well, you know,
low-level what? Low-level sound?
Yes, from low-frequency sound.
Oh, just at the Denver airport.
Just at the Denver airport, over 75 planes.
Wow, so they are generating something underground there that's sonic, that's emanating up through the ground.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, that out last week.
That's amazing. Just last week, we got to look into that and find out what that is. They're probably, if we thought about it, got some engineers on this, we could probably surmise what that low frequency sound would be. It could be construction activities, but also, that leads me to suspect, and this is only in my immediate suspicion because I really haven't had a chance to look into it, but when I hear you say that they're generating low frequency sound, it's evidenced by damaged windshields on aircraft, I would think that they would try to test the integrity of the underground cities by generating this low-frequency sound. As you know, low-frequency sound in physics, if you have the right frequency, you can take an object, a large object such as a bridge, and find the right frequency of sound that will cause that bridge to go into resonance and to vibrate such that it will be destroyed, or a building. It's called, it's a mechanical resonant frequency of an object. Every object has its own resonant frequency dependent upon its shape and size and mass.
And earlier, and, you know,
likewise, they might be testing the underground cities that way to see if do these things really hold up under an earthquake, because the power elite, and I can cite some evidence to indicate that the power elite are very concerned about the integrity of these underground cities when these massive vibrations occur due to these passing bodies and when the earthquakes occur. So they would want to test the viability of them before they go down in there.
Yeah, because they're gravely concerned that they are going to get killed underground from unprecedented earthquakes that we've never seen before, like magnitude 11, 12 earthquakes. But they're so desperate to get underground that they're willing to take that chance because they're more fearful of the solar scorching that's coming.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that one of our show staff, Boris Artemenko, has been talking about when he's been on the show. And incidentally, he was supposed to be coming on about 22 minutes ago, but he has had a severe computer problem due to an electrical storm down in South America where he is, so he's not going to be joining us. But his theory is that the having all of these underground bunkers, these domes, as they're called, is not going to do them any good because the earthquakes, the earth shifts, and everything else that's going to be going on when Planet X crosses, is it's just going to bury them alive.
Right, so that's what I believe. I think, again, we have to surmise because we don't have the evidence. But surmisal is based upon evidence and reasoning, and it's like an educated guess, really, that these guys are really, these power elite, are extremely afraid of going down under there. But remember, God, the supernatural power that's bringing this planet, this brown dwarf star, allowing it to be sucked in by our sun, the supernatural power is not giving the elite, these mere men, any options at all. They are between a rock and a hard place, so to speak. They have to make a choice. Either they stay on the surface of the earth and get scorched to death, which is what will happen pretty soon when the sun goes super hyperactive, or go underground and be protected from the solar scorching, but at the same time risk being killed by the earthquake. So they don't know what to do, and they're afraid. So they have no clear option. It's either way, they're in danger.
Or they go up to the International Space Station or one of the military black ops space stations and hope that they can survive up there. I mean,
no,
that's just an option.
I don't believe that, because that is really a dangerous place to go. Now, the International Space Station, I've been saying for a long time, has to be a weapons platform for shooting down these incoming asteroids. And certainly I give them credit for doing that, because they want to protect the very same Earth that we are on. They're on also, and they want to protect Earth from being struck by these asteroids, which would be, of course, devastating. So I'm glad, whether they keep it secret or not, I guess it's good that they keep it secret, that the International Space Station has been converted to a weapons platform for shooting down asteroids and meteors.
And they become so concerned about these rocks. They become so concerned about all these rocks that are coming in right now that NASA's deployed a new camera network that's currently in, I believe, 3 or 4 states, but they're going to expand it. But this is another subtle way they're going after the amateurs that are going to be the first ones to spot Planet X coming in. They're encouraging amateurs with solar telescopes to keep them apprised of what's going on, and they're encouraging NASA's encouraging folks to help them look for meteorites in the southeast. This is another subtle way they're trying to suck people in, the catalog and the inventory, who that first batch of people are that'll be reporting this to the mass public that Planet X is coming in.
We have the NASA Smart Camera System, that's what it's called. We have the article from NASA, the NASA Science News, on the screen right now for people to see, and they're saying 100 tons of meteorites hit the Earth's atmosphere.
You know, Lucas put on his site that there were 4 asteroids that smashed into the Earth last year, and the mainstream media totally buried it.
Yeah, there was one in Argentina. That big natural gas blast that happened out west, He thinks that was an asteroid strike.
Yeah, I disagree with that, and I'll get into that later. We could talk about that later, but that was a earthquake related, and it was. I checked into it. I won't take too long on that because that's a little bit off the subject. But you're talking about the San Bruno Inferno, and I did some research and found that there was a minor earthquake only a quarter of a mile away because San Bruno is right on the San Andreas Fault. And they're subject to numerous small earthquakes over the years, San Bruno. And its underground gas system must have been highly compromised due to shifting in the earth that occurred as a result of... Hold on a second, please.
Yep.
Well, I could fill that in while he's doing whatever he's doing by saying that these are other subtle effects that are manifesting
in the air.
As Planet X gets closer, you're going to see more natural gas pipeline explosions. You're going to see more train derailments. Yeah, what else is there, John?
Sinkholes. What happened in San Bruno is characteristic of what happens in any area where you have an earthquake, major fault line. If you have small earthquakes, just visualize what's going to happen near those small earthquakes. That occur so frequently over the years. Well, the ground is going to shift, and where gas lines were buried and pretty much secure, you're going to have pockets of earth shifting around. You've seen that in buildings and other areas where there's shifting of the ground below. Pockets form, and now what happens to those gas lines that were so well supported by gravel and compacted dirt, etc., and sand? Well, you get infiltration of rocks, and then you get pockets of formed underneath the gas line, and now you have tremendous, many hundreds of tons of shearing force exerted on those gas pipelines over a period of time, and the pipelines begin to erode and begin to weaken underneath that shearing stress. And eventually, the pipeline will actually shear. Now, a week before the San Bruno explosion occurred, residents were smelling gas and were reporting it to the gas company, and nothing was done about it. They could have prevented that inferno from occurring. That tells you that there was shifting already occurring. And then, at the very time, I did the research and found out that there was a report of a mother who was at a soccer game in a field in San Bruno, and the time that she was at the soccer game when the explosion occurred, according to her newspaper report, was the exact moment within 1 minute from the actual time that this earthquake, this small earthquake, occurred, that I found on the USGS website. It occurred right on the San Andreas Fault, only a quarter of a mile from San Bruno, at that exact moment when it was reported that the explosion occurred. Also, another piece of evidence I have is that I have watched the Weather Channel, and I failed to record it, but I remember very clearly three different San Bruno residents reported signs right before, indications immediately before this explosion occurred, this inferno.
Mm-hmm.
One resident said the house, the walls vibrated for a couple seconds right before the blast. Another resident said there was a loud boom. And I know what these booms are because I live near an earthquake fault myself. And whenever you hear that long extended sonic booming occur, that's a sign of an earthquake. So now we have two witnesses who lived in San Bruno saying that they experienced earthquake signs 2 seconds before the blast occurred. And I have the evidence to show that earthquake was a 1-point-something magnitude.
But yeah, John,
it was close enough to cause, it was like the straw that broke the camel's back, okay? It wasn't wasn't a major earthquake, but that pipe was ready to go. That gas pipeline was ready to go. And so I have all the evidence to show you, based upon the shifting of the earth and what happens to it after numerous small earthquakes and the coincidental occurrences that we have documented, to show that gas pipeline was ready to go and it was not caused by a meteor strike.
I still have the screenshot capture of that quake, just in case the USGS ever decided to pull it down.
And another thing I wanted to mention was we'll also be seeing an increasing number of water main breaks, which is very rampant.
Right. I've been following that, too. And, again, it's all due to the shifting of the Earth. This is all something that's quite understandable, that the Earth is going to shift because we have all kinds of... What we have is the heating of the Earth's mostly molten iron core. And you can liken this to a soft-boiled egg, whereas we're in the yolk, the soft yolk of the egg might be compared to the mostly molten iron core of the Earth, and then the hardened or gelatinous egg white surrounding the yolk might be likened to the mantle of the Earth, which is molten rock and metal mixed. And what happens is that the mostly molten iron core is getting severely heated up, and it's also being disturbed in its circular flow. As the Earth rotates, it creates a circular flow, sort of like a bowl of water on a potter's wheel. If you took a clay bowl filled with water and put it on a potter's wheel, normally, as long as that potter's wheel is stable and it's rotating smoothly, the water inside the bowl will also swirl around smoothly with a dip in the center, and it's okay. But as soon as that potter's wheel is jarred, caused to move a little bit, it will cause the water inside to begin to slosh around and produce waves. And this is what's happening inside the Earth's mostly molten iron core. It's beginning to wave
look at all the volcanoes that we have going up right now.
Yeah, because of the heating of the mostly molten iron core, what happens is you have a lava lamp effect. If you've seen a lava lamp in a child's bedroom, when that lava lamp is turned off, the light is off, there's a pool of lava that just sits and rests in the bottom of this vertical, cylindrical lamp. However, once the light warms up the lava begins to rise upward in a plume. And that's what you have in, the geologists call it, a mantle plumes that come up. They emanate from the molten iron core, sort of from the heating effect, and the gases and hot lava form a plume that rises upward in a column and eventually reaches the underside of the Earth's crust, which is called the lithosphere. And that's what causes the pressure and the gas eruptions and the magma eruptions through the lithosphere. It's all pretty understandable, really. And that's what a volcanic eruption really is. It's magma heated up, coming up through the Earth. And, of course, once the Earth cools down, you still have a hole in the Earth that was generated by that ancient mantle plume where gas pressure came up, sort of like when you're cooking a pot of stew or a pot of pudding. You probably cook pudding until it thickens, and when it thickens, it begins to plop and gas columns start to arise and cause little bubbles and bulges and holes, actually steam vents, in the pudding. You've probably seen that. And that's what's happening now. But when it happened before, the Earth was basically cooling down, and those old steam vents, the volcanoes, became dormant.
Well, John,
but now they're there, and they're ready to heat up again.
And this activity has become so obvious that it has caused over 11,000 earthquakes in the Canary Islands since the middle of July. And this is why I suspect they shut down the space shuttle program at NASA, because They're expecting that island or islands out in the archipelago of the Canary Island chain to eventually cause a landslide-driven tsunami, which is like 10 times worse than an earthquake-driven undersea tsunami. And, I think that there's going to be a mega tsunami eventually created at some point, and that's why they have to shut down the shuttle program, because they know Florida is going to be underwater soon.
Hey, guys, I have a question. At the beginning of the show, before John came on, we were discussing an article that was on Discovery.com, and it was about a new type of particle that the scientists are seeing coming from the sun. And they're saying...
Cover story.
Pardon?
What do you think, John? You think that's a cover story because they don't want us to know how bad these solar storms are going to get?
I haven't. This is the first I've heard about this new kind of particle, so I haven't had a chance
to look at it. They say it's affecting the carbon dating system. And it's affecting the carbon dating system and basically mutating everything. And I'm wondering if it's possible for these particles to be affecting the core of the Earth and whether or not Planet X has some kind of an effect on this, too.
The particles, they say, are affecting the Earth's carbon dating, the carbon dating system that they have.
Yeah.
I know it's carbon-14 is what they use. It's an isotope of carbon that has 14. It's the number of neutrons and protons in the carbon nucleus is 14, and it would decay, you know, from 14 to 13 over a period of time, and it's sort of a time measurement. So you're saying these particles are affecting the carbon dating system. Well, that would have to affect the decay rate, the half-life of radioactive isotopes, isotopes of particular elements that decay. Now, maybe there's a way to do that, but at first glance, I haven't really had a chance to think, to look into it. But it's hard to imagine some kind of particle coming from the sun that would affect the decay rate of any radioactive isotope, such as like uranium-257, for example. If these particles are affecting the carbon dating system, is it because I would presume that they're talking about it changing the half-life of that radioactive isotope.
Yeah.
But then it would change the half. Wouldn't it affect the half-life of uranium-257 and all the other radioactive isotopes?
Well, it sounds like it's changing
the character of atoms.
Well, I've got the article here on the screen for the viewers to see. And it says, it is a well-known and apparently constant characteristic of matter that is behaving mysteriously. This is exactly what's been noticed in recent years. Decay rates of radioactive elements are changing. This is especially mysterious as we are talking about elements with constant decay rates. These values are not supposed to change. And this has come up by researchers at Stanford and Purdue University.
Well, yes, that's amazing. I would never, yeah, they can't figure it out, and I can't either. Why would the half-life of a radioactive isotope, meaning, why would it change? Why would that decay rate change? I mean, it takes so long for, it takes a known period of time for that atom to kick out one of its neutrons. As long as it kicks out a neutron and does not kick out any of its protons, it still remains, its identity still remains the same. For example, if it's carbon, carbon is characterized by a particular number of protons in its nucleus. Even if there are a variable number of neutrons in the nucleus, as long as it has that specific number of protons in its nucleus, it's still identified as carbon or uranium, same thing. A specific number of protons. Now, it's going to kick out a neutron at a particular interval of time, a specific, well-known, you know, predictable period of time. Why would that rate at which it kicks out neutrons, which is actually the process of radioactive decay, why would that time period change? It's characteristic of the atom itself. How could something from the sun affect that? It doesn't make any sense.
I think it's just a cover story, because I did see that report, and it talks about how the sun is cooling down, right, Bill?
Yeah. It's.
Well, that's why I think it's a cover story.
That makes sense.
They have to think of something for the public, because they don't want them to know why it's really acting bizarre. Well, the reason it's really acting bizarre is because the brown dwarf star is affecting it.
Well, the thing that led me to that was an article that I read that said scientists are quote-unquote surprised that the sun is acting strangely. What they're saying is that the sun's core is shrinking faster than they thought. It's emitting a new type of solar particle that is mutating matter. and the sun is moving into a cooling and weakening cycle. And at the same time, over the past 20 years, they say that the solar wind has decreased by 20% and is shrinking the heliosphere of the sun. And that's leaving us relatively unprotected from the radiation and whatnot that's coming in from Planet X.
Well, the solar activity did decrease during 2009, and I think for the reason that I had mentioned before, that Planet X was actually very close as it was passing through, penetrating the underside of the ecliptic, getting close to Jupiter, it drew away most of the, it began to electrically flirt with Jupiter, essentially, and reduce the excitation that normally would have existed between Jupiter and the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's that excitation that sort of determines the activity of the Sun. And so basically the Sun Jupiter had found another lover temporarily as planet, you know, in Planet X as it came by. But that was the only period of low activity of the sun. They're saying its activity has decreased now. That's not true. The sun's activity, from everything I've seen, is increasing now. We're seeing more coronal mass ejections, and very shortly we'll see that this article was probably a lie. As Sheldon says, a cover story to get us looking in the wrong direction, you know, thinking the sun is becoming cooler when in fact it's getting warmer. More active. It sounds like a really fishy story to me.
Yeah, they're talking about the minor minion.
We can attribute that again. It's not the crime that incriminates them, as President Nixon said. It's the cover-up that incriminates them.
Yeah, they're talking about the minor minimum in this article.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. I mean, the sun just got through the Jupiterian maximum, which was sometime early this year, in 2011.
Yeah, March.
Let's say somewhere around the middle of 2011, which is close enough. That's when Jupiter reaches its closest perihelion, is what's called, its closest approach to the Sun in its 11.5-year orbit around the Sun. 1 year on Jupiter is actually 11.5 of our years. And that's when you have the highest activity. So how could they say the Sun is going into a quiet stage when it's going into its really quite close to its peak? It's just gone over the peak of its 11-year Jupiterian cycle, and it should still be very active for the next, let's say, 5.5 years. 5.5 years would be half of the 11-year cycle.
Well, this is another
crazy thing. That doesn't make sense at all. So there's more disinformation coming from these people, and I hope the scientists are either got their mouths are quiet and not observing things, or they've been suppressed, because I don't hear any disagreement from the scientific community.
Well, my understanding was that the peak was supposed to be in 2012.
Well, right, initially NASA told us 2012. Now they're putting it off to 2013. I think they're doing that because they don't want to.
No, there you go. Well, see, now there you go. That shows that they're lying, because they themselves told us that the high solar activity would occur in 2012. Yet they're telling us now that the sun is going quiet, when they just told us it's going hyperactive 3 months from now. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. They're giving us
duplicity. This is another thing. I'm seeing this repeatedly on the internet, that every few weeks we're getting repeated warnings about these solar storms that are coming and how it's going to take down the power grids. And, you know, I'm seeing that repeatedly.
Oh, every
week.
Well,
I think it's true. It's going to happen. As Planet X gets closer, you know, any time a celestial body gets close to the sun, especially a celestial body that is electrified, such as this brown dwarf star that is saturated with protons, that is plasma, electrified gases. These gases were engulfed this comet, this planet coming in on a cometary orbit, as it penetrated the Earth's heliosphere, that is the outer sphere of protons surrounding the solar system.
And when that happened, and John, when the heliosphere got penetrated from Planet X penetrating it, it also caused an increased count on the gamma ray burst. You remember that?
Right. Well, what happened, I think I haven't been following it too closely, but you see, when any object comes in and it penetrates the heliosphere, again, the heliosphere is visualized that as a glowing red globe surrounding the entire solar system. And when an object comes through it, it has to pierce through that glowing red globe made of electrified, electrically sticky plasma. These are all protons, ionized gases. And the incoming comet is electrically saturated with this electrically sticky proton gas, plasma. Now, that's what Planet X is. It's surrounded by plasma, and it in fact has, as it gets closer, that plasma begins to glow as it gets closer to the sun, and you see a red glowing orb in the sky, which is what the ancients had recorded the last time that this planet came in, or this brown dwarf star came in 36 and a half centuries ago. They said it was a red glowing orb with wings. They called it a winged globe. And that's what we can expect to see again when it comes in. But anyway, it's surrounded with plasma and electrified, and it's going to excite the sun electrically. So there, it's a foregone conclusion that we're going to see tremendous solar excitations now. It's beginning now, and it's going to get much worse into next year. And that would explain to me why the people of secrecy and deception who control the media, the power elite, would give you stories that would be contrary to what's actually happening. They're saying, oh, the sun's calming down, when in fact we know, they know it's just about ready to go very hyperactive.
Yeah, we just had a newly
easy to see through their transparent lies.
Yeah, now we have a newly released report being put up by NASA's mouthpiece, space.com, about this barrage of the discovery of these new alien exoplanets out there. And this is exactly the type of disinformation they're doing is desensitizing the public, so that when the final big boy finally does get here, people are going to say, "Oh yeah, right, just another a stupid planet out there," and then they can go back and watch their football games.
Right, exactly.
And you
Mark
also
Hazelwood
talked about
Mark Hazelwood predicted that about 9 years ago. He said, what they're going to do is, and they're doing, that's exactly what they're doing, but just as he predicted, they're going to come out with so many different reports about celestial bodies being sighted that the public will become jaded and even irritated at hearing all of these reports, so much so that they'll just turn away in disgust. And when the big red, when that red dot in the sky starts getting bigger and brighter, they'll look at it, and hopefully the power elite is going to think that the public will just become desensitized and disregard it. But I don't think they will, because it'll become so prominent at a certain point. And the elite know this. They know that they can only keep us off guard and distracted for a limited period of time. They know that their plan of deception can only be partially effective, and they're fighting a losing battle. Trying to go underground, because they're going to be crushed under there. They know that. They're fighting a losing battle, keeping the public distracted.
They're just trying to buy time is all they're doing.
That's right, exactly.
And you know, they're John, desperate. They are desperate. You know, that red dot in the sky you were talking about, not only is the symbolism for that showing on the Chrysler car logo, but they'll also throw it in during the middle of a wrestling show, which they did earlier this year on that Sci-Fi SmackDown World Wrestling Federation show. They just threw that in.
And it was one. Now they had to say, "What? How did they portray it?"
Well, it was about halfway through the wrestling show, and they mentioned they just threw it in out of the middle of nowhere about Nibiru.
Oh, they did. They actually stated, they came out with a statement in the middle of the wrestling match that some kind of Nibiru was coming in or something?
Yeah, they were trying to portray the wrestling people on the show you know, as these Greek goddesses or something, and they just threw in somebody was getting wrestled, and they say, Planet X, Nibiru.
Oh, I see. I understand. Yeah, they were trying to turn it into some ridiculous concept. And they've done this in the past. In fact, you know, way back in 2002, I believe it was, when there was a lot of talk about Planet X coming in, but it really didn't. It came in, you know, has been much delayed. But there was a lot of public hysteria beginning to build up in anticipation of this planet coming in. And what they did on the David Letterman show was they had a whole spoof on Planet X. It was really ridiculous. A friend of mine told me that he had seen it. I didn't see it. But then I went to the David Letterman show website, and I got all the information about this particular. It was just a one-night thing where they ridiculed the concept of Planet X. And you're going to get more of that right now, more ridiculing of it. Again, as President Nixon had said, it's not the crime that incriminates them, it's the cover-up that incriminates them when they try to cover up the crime. There's been a cover-up, too. There's so many, I don't know how many we could recount, but there was a spokesman for NASA, and you can find him on YouTube. I forget his name.
Oh, I hate that guy.
He says, you probably can remember what it was. We could look it up. He says, people are talking about this Nibiru or Planet X. Well, if it were coming in, we would have seen it by now. Well, first of all, they did see it. Secondly, it's not visible except with infrared instruments, infrared telescopes, because right now it's emitting infrared light. It hasn't gotten close enough to actually light up to emit light from the visible spectrum, but it will when it gets closer to the sun. So that was a big lie right there.
NASA had an internal
project tracking it. There's an astronomical planetary report put out, I believe, in 1991. I mean, this guy discrediting it. I guess he forgets about the internal NASA project. You know, it's been well known by the astronomical community that Planet X has been a reality for, what, 110 years, John?
Yeah, I mean, if you look, in fact, let me read this article to you. This is very important to read. Now, when people say, well, I'm hearing all this information from Sheldon and John and Bill, and I don't know what to believe. I haven't heard it in the mass media, so I still don't know if it's true, because I don't believe anything until I hear it coming from the mass media. Well, here it is. It was covered up. It came out at a time when they were not quite so secure about suppressing this information, and they let it slip. The National Security Agency let this slip out back in 1983. I'm going to read. I went and photocopied the article. Bill, I'm going to email you this high-resolution JPEG photo of the actual New York Times article that I got from my library archives.
Okay.
My county
library. If anybody
library.
Wants to go to my website, they can find it there, thelightofdayradioshow.com.
Okay, thelightofdayradioshow.com.
I'll put a link up
on
the
Planet
show
X
page.
Logo at the top. It's thelightofdayradioshow.com. Click on the Planet X logo, and it'll bring you to a huge Planet X page. And you can find that New York Times. Look for the New York Times article on Sheldon's webpage. But here it is here. New York Times, Sunday, January 30th. Title, Clues Get Warm in the Search for Planet X. January 30th, 1983. Clues Get Warm in the Search for Planet X by John Noble Wilford. Quote, something out there beyond the farthest reaches of the known solar system seems to be tugging at Uranus and Neptune. Some gravitational force keeps perturbing the two giant planets, causing irregularities in their orbits. The force suggests a presence far away and unseen, a large object that may be the long-sought Planet X. Evidence assembled in recent years has led several groups of astronomers to renew the search for this 10th planet. They are devoting more time to visual observations with the 200-inch telescope at Mount Palomar in California. They are tracking two Pioneer spacecraft now approaching the orbit of distant Pluto to see if variations in their trajectories provide clues to the source of this mysterious gravitational force. And they're hoping that a satellite-borne telescope launched last week will detect heat signatures from this planet or whatever it is out there. The infrared astronomical satellite, IRAS, was boosted into a 560-mile high polar orbit Tuesday night from Vandenberg Air Force Base, California. It represents an $80 million venture by the United States, Britain, and the Netherlands. In the next 6 or 7 months, this telescope is expected to conduct a wide-ranging survey of nearly all the sky, detecting sources not of ordinary light, but of infrared radiation, which is invisible to the human eye and largely absorbed by the atmosphere. Scientists thus hope that this new telescope will chart thousands of infrared-emitting objects that have gone undetected, stars, interstellar clouds, asteroids, and with any luck, this object that gravitationally pulls at Uranus and Neptune, this planet X. The last time a serious search of the skies was made, it led to the discovery in 1930 of Pluto, the ninth planet. But this story begins more than a century before that, after the discovery of Uranus in 1781 by the English astronomer and musician William Herschel. Until then, the planetary system seemed to end with Saturn. As astronomers observed Uranus, noting irregularities in its orbital path, many speculated that they were witnessing the gravitational pull of an unknown planet. So began the first planetary search based on astronomers' predictions, which ended in the 1840s with the discovery of Neptune, almost simultaneously by English, French, and German astronomers. But Neptune was not massive enough to account entirely for the orbital behavior of Uranus. Indeed, Neptune itself seemed to be affected by a still more remote planet. In the late 19th century, two American astronomers, William Pickering and Percival Lowell, predicted the size and approximate location of this trans-Neptunian body, which Lowell called Planet X. Years later, Pluto was detected by Clyde Tombaugh, working at Lowell Observatory in Arizona.
Hey, Don?
And it goes on and on, and it says, yes, go ahead.
Well, I'd like to interject by saying that the reason they named Pluto what it became is because they were actually looking for Planet X.
Yeah, exactly. That's what, in fact, I have a videotape of Science Channel documentary on the discovery of Pluto, and it actually says in this, you can find it probably on YouTube, the Science Channel documentary on the discovery of Pluto in 1930. It said Clyde Tombaugh of the Lowell Observatory was searching for Planet X, and he serendipitously found Pluto. So there you go. I mean, that's even stated. But anyway, continuing on. Recent calculations by the, this is from the New York Times, January 30th, 1983, before the National Security Agency had a chance to stifle any speakers or scientists on this subject. Quote, recent calculations by the United States Naval Observatory have confirmed the orbital perturbation exhibited by Uranus and Neptune, which Dr. Thomas Van Flandern, an astronomer at the observatory, says could be explained by, quote, a single undiscovered planet, end of quote. He and a colleague, Dr. Robert Harrington, whom we talked about before, had been murdered later on, years after this article was printed. Van Flandern and his colleague, Dr. Robert Harrington, calculate that the 10th planet should be 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth. And incidentally, later on I'll explain why they deliberately planted that as disinformation, because if they really told you how massive a brown dwarf star is, like 1,000 times the mass of Earth, people would be panicky. So they planted this disinformation, I surmise, to suppress any panic that might occur from the public. He and colleague Dr. Robert Harrington calculate that this 10th planet should be 2 to 5 times more massive than Earth and have a highly elliptical orbit. Again, incidentally, visualize the outline of a cucumber. That would be sort of like the orbital trajectory, orbital path of an elliptical comet. It takes, and it says that it has a highly elliptical orbit that takes it some 5 billion miles beyond that of Pluto. Now, here's a very important statement. They say it's 5 billion miles is hardly next door, but still within the gravitational influence of the Sun. This is stated by the scientist, Dr. Harrington. Now, if it was then, in 1983, within the gravitational influence of the Sun, it would have been sucked in continuously from that time on until now toward the Sun. It has to be. It's basic physics. It's like an asteroid. Imagine an asteroid that gets within the gravitational influence of Earth. Even though it's way, way up there, many miles high, it's still barely within the weak gravitational influence of Earth. It's going to be gradually pulled down toward Earth, and as it gets closer, the gravitational force of attraction will increase, and therefore its acceleration will also increase until it comes hurtling toward Earth. And that's exactly what is happening with this brown dwarf star, except that it's not hurtling toward Earth, it's hurtling toward the Sun.
John, one of the indicators of this is an email I got from Richard St. Laurent up in Canada. He's another outstanding Planet X researcher. He showed me in this email these graphs of all these near-Earth object asteroids that had just gone up through the roof in the late 90s, so that would just be another indicator.
So you mean there's been a tremendous increase in near-Earth objects that were sighted, huh?
Yeah, that
been a big increase.
Right.
Ever since from then until now.
I would say late 90s, maybe 97 or 98, that number just went through the roofs. And, you know, Planet X has an entourage of accompanying celestial objects with it as it comes in.
Right. So, I mean, as it gets closer, visualize Planet X as a huge beehive traveling through space, you know, with a swarm of bees swarming all around it. Now, that would be the gravitationally captured comets and celestial bodies of all sizes, actually, everything from the size of small planets down to comets and then smaller objects such as asteroids and then even smaller objects such as meteors, then boulders, rocks, and even a cloud of iron oxide dust which it surrounds it. And that's another thing that makes it difficult to see is that cloud of dust. Besides the fact that it emits only infrared light, which is, not only visible with infrared telescopes. But the ancient historians tell us, and even the Bible is a very good ancient historical book. The Bible tells us in the book of Exodus that the waters of Egypt turned red during the time of all these cataclysms. Well, that would be explained by the tail of this comet, or one of its... this huge brown dwarf star on a cometary orbit, its tail sweeping the Earth with iron oxide dust that would pollute the water. And indeed, if you go to the book of Exodus, I could read it directly to you, but I could paraphrase it right now. The water was so bitter and foul from this redness that polluted the waters that the people were getting sick from drinking it. And they were digging feverishly trying to find wells, freshwater wells, throughout Egypt during this time. And not only is the book of Exodus described this event, but also the Colburn Bible, and specifically the Ipuwer Papyrus, I-P-U-W-E-R. This is an Egyptian historian who lived through these great cataclysms. He describes pretty much the same thing, that the waters were foul and polluted, and people would vomit just from drinking this water. So
John,
we see what's going to happen to Earth when this red iron oxide dust sweeps, its tail sweeps Earth.
Well, that's another subtle way that they're leaking it out through TV shows. They did a remake of that TV series, V. Remember that?
What was the name of it?
V. V as in Victor, where these alien humans are living here on Earth with us. The original one came out in the 80s, but they did a remake of it, and the title of the last episode of the first season was like Red Rain or Red Dust, and then...
Oh, really?
I mean, they subtly tell us this stuff all the time, and then Don also
came across.
Well, maybe we could find that. Maybe we could find that episode of V. It's titled "Red Dust" or "Red Rain." We could find that on YouTube. Maybe YouTube has practically everything.
One episode was called "Red Rain" and the other "Red Dust." I don't. Yeah, it's interesting. But John also come across this verse in the Bible, Isaiah 63, where it says God will send from afar his glittering blood-red object to its distant goal, which is earth. Can you tell the audience about that, John?
Yeah. I guess maybe as things get more disastrous, people tend to turn closer to God and seek out that invisible being. You know, we wonder why our hearts are beating constantly, who keeps us going, who gives us the magic, miracle of life, and the wonderful things around us that sustain us and beautify our world. And of course, we all know that there's a God, but we ignore that God when times are easy. Well, now the times have been getting more difficult and more harrowing. I've been getting closer in my thoughts to the existence of God. Again, it sounds sort of hypocritical. You know, we turn to God when we need him out of fear, but we don't tend to turn to him when things are going well. Well, I started to read the Bible, and I knew that I had to pray the Bible because there's some symbolism is just so deep that no human mind could fathom some of the symbolism in the Bible. So as I was making myself consciously aware of the invisible presence of God and reading the Bible, I got this compulsion to go to the book of Isaiah, chapter 63, and start reading. And as I was reading, I was amazed at the symbolic likeness of this Isaiah 63 with the incoming planet X. And let me see if I can... I could take it out of the King James or the complete Jewish Bible, maybe.
Well, John's looking that up. I'd also like to tell the audience that it must have been 2 or 3 years ago they had this tremendous red-colored iron oxide dust storm over Australia, and as we know, that's in the Southern Hemisphere, right, John?
That's right. Now, the dust could not have been from the tail of Planet X, because Planet X has not gotten that close to Earth yet. But
right,
the red
but Gilbert
dust,
Erickson, he said he thinks that that was a Planet X-related event.
Well, I mean, it could have been a comet. Now, a comet that was saturated with or engulfed in red iron oxide dust. Yeah, if that comet came by Earth, it could have happened, but I don't know. I mean, it's just so hard to say to draw a parallel between that red dust storm, and it certainly is something related to these celestial phenomena that are occurring now. I agree. It's just that it's hard to really say that it's related to being swept by the tail of a comet, because if we were swept by the tail of a comet, do you know what size of land masses that would engulf? That would cover much of the Earth, but this happened in a localized section of Australia, maybe 5 or 10 square miles, something like that. So I don't know what it was. It's some kind of strange phenomenon, but indeed it's related to these crazy celestial events that are occurring. Indeed, all this crazy weather is. But here's Isaiah chapter 63, quote, who is this coming from Edom? Now, Edom symbolizes red, something red, okay? So there you go. There's a red. We know Planet X is a red body when it lights up. It's been stated that way by the ancient historians. Who is this coming from Edom, from Basra? And Basra symbolizes coming from the east. Coming from Basra with clothing stained crimson, red, so magnificently dressed, so stately in his great strength. Quote, it is I who speak victoriously, I, the Savior. And that smacks of the Lord Jesus, the Savior. Why? And then Isaiah answers God. He says, why is your apparel red? Your clothes are like someone treading a winepress. And God answers the Savior answers. I have trodden the winepress alone. From the peoples, not one was with me. In other words, there's not one that was perfect and righteous with him. Every one of us is imperfect. He says, from the peoples, not one was with me. So I trod them in my anger, trampled them in my fury. So their lifeblood spurted out on my clothing, and I have stained all my garments. Wow. For the day of vengeance that was in my heart, and my year of redemption, that means he's going to redeem some. My year of redemption has come. So some will be saved and some will be destroyed. I looked, this is God speaking again, the Savior who's coming in crimson, in the skies. I looked, but there was no one to help. That means there's no one righteous that he could say his with him. And I was appalled that no one upheld me. Therefore, my own arm brought me salvation. Salvation. That's what we find throughout the New Testament. And my own fury upheld. Do you hear someone talking in the background? I hope that's not my son yelling downstairs. And my own fury upheld me. In my anger, I trod down the peoples, made them drunk with my fury, then poured out their lifeblood on the earth. Well, I looked up the word lifeblood. And it really is not lifeblood at all. In the Hebrew, the original Hebrew from when this Isaiah was spoken in the Hebrew language and was given, wrote the first manuscripts in Hebrew, it's actually not lifeblood, but it is defined in the concordance. There's a Strong's concordance of every Hebrew language, every Hebrew word in the Bible. And in the Strong's concordance, it says that this word really means a bright, red, blood red, glittering object coming from the greatest distance away to its goal. So now I put plug that word in to where the word lifeblood is, and it says it poured out or brought this bright red, glittering, blood red object from the greatest distance to its goal, earth. So that's what it says. God is actually prophesying that he's going to bring this object toward earth to cause destruction. And the sign of the Son of Man, he says, you're going to look in the heavens and see the sign of the Son of Man coming with great power and glory. Well, scientifically, that's explained by what we know is a phenomenon of electricity and magnetism, whereby this winged globe, which the ancients actually described as a winged globe, it's a glowing plasma-drenched comet coming in. As it gets close to the sun, the solar winds interact, start blasting out waves of protons from the sun toward this incoming object. It's like a flirtation, electrical flirtation, and an electromagnetic flirtation, too, because the sun is swirling out what's called the interplanetary magnetic field, constantly swirling this outward. And an interplanetary magnetic field and this electrical solar winds are interacting with this oncoming comet that's rendezvousing with the sun. And you see, and historians told us they saw, flaming, red, glowing streams streaming out laterally, sideways, from this red glowing globe. And it looked like a glowing red winged globe. But as that globe gets closer to the earth, which is what it's prophesied to do very soon, there a discharging occurs. And this is perfectly understandable when you realize that this electrical discharge occurs whenever a body, a highly electrified body, gets close to what's called a ground or a highly receptive, electrically receptive body such as earth. If you're walking on a carpet, picking up a lot of static electrons on your body, and you approach a doorknob, you get very close. How many of us have experienced this? Get very close, your hand almost touches the doorknob, and all of a sudden you get this sharp, stinging zap. It's a discharge of electricity from your body. You built up an excess of electrical charge, and now it's discharging to this receptive metal object, the doorknob. Every one of us has been stung in that way. Well, that's exactly what will happen on a cosmic scale when this comet comes by with already streaming solar winds blowing out sideways, giving it wings. It's going to discharge down, and what is formed? An electrical glowing sign of the cross. A cross. A discharging vertical column of plasma will discharge to the earth, and that's the sign of the Son of Man that the Lord Jesus prophesies in the Bible, where he says, you'll see the sign of the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with great power and glory.
Hey, John, I have a question for you.
You guys, I got to go. I got company, but this has been great. And
you're going to leave for company? You're going to go away from us just for some company?
Oh, that's unbelievable.
I've been expecting somebody to come and see me, and they're here now, but I'll just let Don finish with you, Bill.
Okay, that's good. Thanks for coming on, Sheldon.
Great joining you guys. It was great.
Okay. Good being with you. Take care, man.
Talk to you later, guys.
Thanks, Sheldon.
Yeah, bye-bye.
John, I have a question for you about the biblical passage that we're talking about right now. And that is this. Didn't the ancient Native Americans, the Indians and the possibly the Mayans, didn't they also have a caricature of this two-winged object? I believe they called it, the blue kachina and the red kachina, and they also had the Thunderbird symbol. Isn't this the same thing?
Right, exactly. That's right. That Thunderbird was what the natives of Central America, Mexico, and South America saw in the sky. Well, it's actually the American Indians of the southwestern U.S., right?
Yes.
They had the Thunderbird symbol. And I'm looking at Zechariah Sitchin, incidentally, the great archaeologist and ancient historian. He wrote the landmark book, The 12th Planet, and he passed away. He died just about a year ago, I think, during this past year. He wrote the landmark book, The 12th Planet, which most of us have heard of and read at least parts of. And I'm reading from page 240 of Zechariah Sitchin's book, The 12th Planet. And this is what it says here on page 240. Recognized as a great traveler in the heavens, soaring to immense heights at its apogee. That means as its greatest distance away from the earth, and then coming down, bowing unto the heaven at its perigee. That is, as its closest approach to earth. This planet was depicted as a winged globe. So he's saying when it gets close to Earth at perigee, the planet became a winged globe. Well, it certainly would begin to glow more, even at, going above there as it got closer to the sun and right above the Earth moving toward the sun, the solar excitations would make it glow and stream out protons in both laterally from it to both sides, forming what appear to be wings on this globe. And it says, continues in this Zechariah Sitchin quotation, wherever archaeologists uncovered the remains of Near Eastern peoples, the symbol of the winged globe was conspicuous, dominating temples and palaces, carved on rocks, etched on cylinder seals, painted on walls. It accompanied kings and priests. It stood above their thrones, hovered above them in battle scenes, was etched into their chariots. Clay, metal, stone, and wood objects were adorned with this symbol. And it goes on and on. It says, the rulers of all these nations, Sumer and Akkad, Babylon, and the rulers of Assyria, all revered this symbol. The Hittite kings, the Egyptian pharaohs, the Persian shahs, all proclaimed this symbol and what it stood for supreme. They proclaimed it supreme, and it remained so for millennia. Central to the religious beliefs and astronomy of the ancient world was the conviction that this 12th planet, the planet of the gods, remained within the solar system and that its grand orbit returned it periodically to Earth's vicinity. The pictographic sign for this 12th planet, the planet of the crossing, was a cross. Imagine that. lacrosse. So there you go. That sort of confirms what I was saying, that will happen again as this winged globe, it becomes a winged globe due to the solar flirtation that occurs as it approaches its rendezvous with the sun. And then the wings take on a new, the globe takes on not only the wings, but a vertical discharging comet, a vertically discharging column of electrified plasma as it discharges to the Earth, forming the vertical bar of a cross,
mm-hmm.
the sign of the cross. So this is really amazing, really very, very prophetic. And I think it tells people that, you know, turn to God in your hearts, no matter what image we have of God. And we should be actually receptive and respectful of whatever concept a person has of God. Because remember, when that person begins to communicate with God in their mind and just recognize his appearance and take some time away from the loves of this world and the cares of this world to communicate spiritually through meditation. I really do believe that meditation is a way to get closer to God. I think the Hindus and the people who practice meditation have the right idea. Clearing your mind of all extraneous thoughts and just feeling, imagining the presence of God, and then you can commune with him. Well, if we were to do that, suppose we have a false image or a mistaken image of God, you know, like some people do. It doesn't matter what our notion of his character is. If we simply commune with him, he will then transfer to our minds his own character and his own being and his ways. So I'm never afraid of anyone who says, yeah, I believe in God, but not the Christian way. Because the real God will make himself known to anyone who opens their minds to him.
Now, this would be the Spirit of God, right?
Yeah, it's an invisible spirit, and we cannot see God. He's invisible. Well, we certainly can feel his, like Planet X, you know, they could not see Planet X way out there when it was pulling on the outer planets, tugging at the planets in their orbit. But certainly they knew that it existed because of its effects, its gravitational pull.
Right.
Similarly, we cannot see God, but we can see his effects all around us. We can see him prophesying in the Bible that, look, I'm bringing the end of this world, and we're seeing the effects of it right now. We're seeing the beginning of the end. It's no time to be cynical. It's no time to be agnostic. Just reach out and say to yourself, look, what do I have to lose? Why am I so resistant to at least meditating and communing with God? And even I've always said to people, look, just say to God, I don't even know if you're there. I don't know if you exist, but I'm willing to give it a little try. Spend a few minutes and just sit here and meditate, clear my mind, close my eyes, or look out at some of the beauty of nature outside my window or in my backyard, and just meditate and feel and expect your presence and your spirit to influence me, my mind. And why not do that? What are we afraid of? Or are we afraid of someone taking control of our minds, taking control of us? Maybe that's what it is.
Well, I don't know
about
that.
That's what I advise everyone to do.
I've never experienced that myself. I mean, as we talked a little bit earlier this afternoon, folks, and I mean, I'm a Christian, and I have never had God take me over and, you know, move me around like a puppet. But that also goes into something else, and that is the evil forces, the satanic forces that are acting on the ones that we call the powers that be, and uh-huh. what they're doing right now, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Lord Jesus, and those of who don't believe that he was God, it's okay. You know, I mean, I certainly know that he's God, but I respect other people's opinions to believe he was not God, but he was just a wonderful prophet, a great prophet, and a great man of truth. Okay, let's just assume that's all he was a great prophet and a great man of truth. he had said, stated in numerous places in the Bible, that if you're not with me, you're against me. So he knew he was God. He spoke as God. He was saying, if you don't have my spirit, you've got the devil's spirit. That's what he meant when he said, if you're not with me, you're against me. And then he also said, fortified that interpretation by saying that when the demonic spirit is cast out of a man, that spirit wanders around. Now here we have the Lord Jesus, a man of great truth and honesty who never lied. Mm-hmm. He said that spirit wanders around looking for a new home after he's been cast out of someone's body. And wandering around, finding no place, he decides to go back to where he came, and he finds that past home all prepared for him, garnished, swept clean, because that person no longer keeps the Spirit of God with him. That person has cast out the demon, turned to God, but now he's drifted back to, you know, away from God. And as a result, he's allowed the vacuum, created a vacuum in his soul that allows that demon to come right back in and dwell in him and bring, and Jesus says, and he brings seven more demons with him. And the state of that man, the last state of that man, is worse than it ever was before. So that demon really secures his stronghold inside that person, or that fallen angel really secures his stronghold by bringing other spirits in with him. And we see other passages in the Bible where Jesus, which we acknowledge as a man of great truth who didn't lie, he tells us that he came across a man who was lived in a cave, a man of superhuman strength, fierce man, vicious man, wild man. He had to be chained down, and he would actually break the chains. Well, the Lord Jesus says he went to this man and told the demons inside of him to get out of him. He said, how many are you? And they replied to him, Jesus, the Son of God, the Son of the Most High God, what are you, why are you bothering us? Why have you come to trouble us before our time? Now, they knew their time was when they were going to be destroyed at some time in history, in future history. And they were deathly afraid of him, and they knew they had to obey him. These are fallen angels who have to obey God. They have to live under his rules. That's why they can't. They would love to kill you or me, these demons, but they cannot, because God forbids them to go only a certain distance. They can manipulate us. They're allowed to manipulate us, but they're not allowed to do certain things to us. Well, anyway, they said, why don't you leave us alone? It's not our time. And he cast them out of this man. He said, how many are you in there, in this man? And they said, we are legion. So it's really amazing how spirits can indwell people. So anyone who is afraid of the Spirit of God coming in to bring that person joy and love, it's the Spirit of love. God is perfect love. Anyone who's afraid of being indwelled by perfect love must realize that they're already indwelled by anti-love. And we all have that anti-love spirit in us, that capability. It just doesn't come out all the time. It comes out when we get angry or when I get insulted. My pride is hurt. I'd lash out sometimes in anger. We all do. But if we keep the Spirit of God in us, then we can realize, wow, we can see how vulnerable we are to these demons. So that's why I say we have to invite God into us, because right now we're indwelled by demonic spirits who always don't always make us vicious and villainous and evil. Their purpose is simply to keep us away from God. And if they could do that by making us wonderful humanitarians who feel great pride in their good nature, in their godly nature, well, that's even better, because then they've tricked us into believing that we have attained perfect goodness. And many people are deluded into thinking that they have achieved perfect goodness and that they don't really need God. And that's what the demon's purpose is, to deceive them. Oh, I'm such a wonderful person. I remember thinking that of myself for years, because I was a humanitarian. And then I realized that even our nature is not perfect. I mean, there's the perfection of God that we cannot even comprehend. After all, look at what he's created with his perfection. And look what I can create with my imperfection. Nothing. I can't create anything. So, anyway, that's a great impetus for turning to God, especially now when we're at the point of destruction, where we're facing the superhuman forces of nature, earthquakes, etc., that are going to destroy most of the people alive today will be dead in a few years.
Yeah, so the Georgia Guidestones aren't exactly incorrect in what they say.
No, I mean, this is what these demonically possessed leaders of the world who actually worship Satan, that's how they got to such a high level. They worship the demon spirits and have given themselves over to them. And you've heard of the old story about selling your soul to the devil. You've mm-hmm. seen movies about it, Devil's Advocate, where someone sold his soul to the devil in order to achieve power and wealth. Well, that's exactly what these men of power do. And they are, the purpose is to kill as many people as possible. Now, in their own human minds, they feel like they're doing it in order to reduce their opposition, their rebellion forces, because they know that they cannot be dictators and totalitarian leaders of the world with 6.5 billion people as opponents, as rebels. So they have to exterminate what they say in the Georgia Guidestones is 12 out of 13 people alive on planet Earth. They say they have to reduce the population to 500 million. Well, we have 6.5 billion people on the Earth now.
Right.
So they want to reduce it to 500 million. Do the arithmetic. That's killing 12 out of every 13 people.
That's a lot.
I mean, that's worse. That makes Hitler seem like a Boy Scout, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, well, we know that he was evil incarnate.
Right, and yet these people are far more evil than Hitler was.
Yeah, and they make it
seem
like...
these are the guys who put Hitler in power anyway.
And these are the guys that want to make us think that we're, you know, they're looking out for us. They're in charge, you know, while they're crashing the economic system and everything else.
And poisoning us in so many different ways. The food is just so, viciously poisonous. I mean, everything they do, it's just so obvious. With mercury in the high fructose corn syrup, that's mm-hmm. mercury is a deadly metal. And I can go on and on. Fluoride in the water for all these years, and so many different toxic chemicals in the food ingredients themselves, and MSG, and it just goes on and on. We could spend hours just describing all the poisons that they've been afflicting us with.
And we definitely don't have hours left.
yeah, we don't.
No, we've been on 2.5 hours tonight, folks. And this is an excellent show. One of our producers, she is asking a scientific question. And her question is when we start to get more interaction with Planet X and this system that is coming in. Planet X is just it's part of a larger system that's coming in. You have the what's supposed to be the brown dwarf and a bunch of bodies that orbit around it, and Planet X is part of that. When this comes in and this starts interacting with the Earth and we start getting all of these earthquakes, she's wondering what types of tsunamis, wave heights specifically, what historically can we look for on this particular
passage? Well, I believe now the ancient Egyptian priests who were visited by the great philosopher and his Greek philosopher and historian Plato, I think it was around, what was it? Was it 600 BC or 300
right around
BC?
There.
I'm trying to remember.
650, 600 BC, right around there.
Okay, right. Around 600 BC, Plato visited the ancient Egyptian priests, and the Egyptians prided themselves in being the greatest historians in the world.
Isn't that where we get the Colburn Bible from?
Pardon me?
Isn't that where we get parts of the Colburn Bible from?
Yes. Right, the Ipawer Papyrus, I believe. The Copan Bible describes catastrophes that occurred with the last passage of Planet X 36 and a half centuries ago. And there was a man named, I have to do more study on, there's another person too, but one of them was Ipawer, I believe, I-P-U-W-E-R, and he survived it and wrote about the catastrophes that he experienced, and these descriptions run parallel to what the Bible tells us in the book of Exodus regarding the 10 plagues of Egypt. But the tsunamis now you're talking about, back the ancient Egyptian historians, I believe, told, I have to go look at the quotations from the books written, the Critias and the Timaeus, two papers written by historical documents, I think written by Plato, where he relates what the Egyptian priests told him came from their history of the sinking of Atlantis, which is believed to have occurred around 9,000 BC, that these waves that inundated the continent of Atlantis were like hundreds of feet high, many hundreds of feet high. I mean, whole landmasses were sunk. And so these tsunamis are going to be, people have to be prepared. Well, right now they haven't gotten real bad, so we can take evasive action. And my plan was this, for everyone living on the East Coast, we have about 40 million, 50 million people living along the East Coast of the United States. Mm-hmm. But let's not forget the poor people down in Central America and South America, too, and also in Canada. Every one of them will be inundated when this, what the geologists tell us is a great, great threat of a tsunami originating in the Canary Islands. On one particular island in the Canary Islands, the island of La Palma, which contains the volcanic mountain, the Cumbre Vieja volcanic mountain. Now, Dr. Simon Day, who is the leading, and Dr. Bill McGuire, the leading geologist stationed on the island, the Canary Island of La Palma, they tell us in this wonderful documentary that has been presented on many times on the Discovery Channel. It's from the BBC, British Broadcasting Company, TV. And it warns people over and over again about this possible tsunami. It doesn't talk about Planet X, but they're so concerned about the tsunami, and I think some of the producers know that there is a threat of Earth changes due to Planet X, and that's why they're airing this program. It's called Mega Tsunami. Mm-hmm. They tell us, Dr. Simon Day and Dr. Bill McGuire of University College London tell us that this western flank of the Cumbre Vieja volcano has been dislocated, totally disconnected from the mountain proper. It's the western flank and the far eastern end of the Atlantic Ocean, right off the coast of Africa. When that dislocated slab, slides into the ocean, it will create a tsunami. They have scientifically studied, using computer calculations and small-scale modeling, to give us an accurate estimation of the height of the tsunami wave. The scientists at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich, Switzerland, have done most of the research to estimate the size of this wave, which would be caused by the collapse of this western flank of the mountain into the Atlantic Ocean. The western flank weighing, what Dr. Simon Day tells us, is a half trillion tons of rock. A half a trillion tons would slide at and cause a displacement of water. It's like punching, you know, your fist into a water, or throwing a heavy, so let's say you took a bowling ball and plunged it into a swimming pool. During the time that bowling ball is penetrating the water, it's displacing far more water than the actual volume of the bowling ball. So likewise, when this mountain plunges in, it's going to displace far more water than its actual volume.
Mm-hmm.
When this western flank of the mountain collapses. And they say it will create a tsunami. Well, the first plop, they say, will be higher than two Empire State Buildings. It will travel across the Atlantic Ocean toward the Americas at a speed of about 450 miles an hour. It'll take about 8 hours to reach the east coast of the Americas. no one will have adequate time to evacuate. The governments don't care. The governments are not even telling us about this because, of course, their purpose is to reduce the population anyway.
Right.
So it's up to the citizenry to get together to organize. And I've been trying to get people, to prompt people to contact emergency medical personnel, to find the most receptive, motivated people we could find would be emergency medical personnel and firefighters. These people are trained to deal with emergencies, to tackle emergencies, and not to flee from in fear from emergencies. So these are the people we have to contact and organize and alert to this growing threat. The scientists on La Palma, Dr. Simon Day and Dr. Bill McGuire, have been warning this year about increases in earthquake activity, as Sheldon had mentioned, all around the island of La Palma. In fact, they had to evacuate people from one of the Canary Islands this summer because of increasing earthquakes. And there is a volcano actually bursting upward from the seafloor just north of one of the islands, very close, getting close to the island of La Palma. So even the disruption of the Earth's surface around that area could dislodge that half-trillion-ton western flank of the Cumbre Vieja volcanic mountain and trigger this instantaneous tsunami, and we wouldn't have advance warning. But the scientists there have gauges and instrumentation that can monitor this the activity, and whenever these scientists warn us that we're in a high alert mode, that's when we can take evasive action.
Right.
So that's what we need to do. We need to notify the population. Now, where would these EMT people be? They would be in the most vulnerable areas. That's where we want to contact them. Atlantic City, New York, Boston, Norfolk, Virginia, Miami, Daytona Beach. Because they know, these responders know that they would be killed, their wives and children would be killed by the tsunami. They would be most likely to become very active.
Right.
That's whom we have to organize, to prompt, to inform, to educate about this incoming planet. And I've already been contacting some scientists to, I shouldn't say that because, take that back, because it's not very good for my safety to be talking about that. But of course, we all know that we're going to try to contact scientists.
Right.
And inform them of this danger.
Yeah, and the emergency management people.
Right, well, I wouldn't even... Emergency management, yeah, but, you know, they're the government, and I don't know. I'm always afraid of contacting anybody close to the government because that's when they come out and try to...
That's when the long knives come out.
Pardon me?
That's when the long knives come out.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I would never go to try to get an interview with anybody high up in the scientific community.
So we're talking paramedics, nurses.
But if you talk to, paramedics, they're right. These grassroots people, those are the kind of people you want to reach.
Firemen?
Yeah, and first responders and, you know, people who really care, who are trained to deal with emergencies, even police, although, you know, the police aren't quite as heightened in their training for emergencies as are the emergency medical personnel and the firemen. But, you know, all these people, and again, if you notify these kinds of people where they themselves and their families are vulnerable to this destructive tsunami, if you can really convince them that this tsunami is becoming more likely every day, I think they would organize.
What kind of an effect would this event have on the West Coast?
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that. On the West Coast, and there's an oceanographer named at the University of Hawaii named Gary McMurtry. He talks about this in that mega tsunami documentary by the BBC. You should look that up on YouTube. It's called Mega Tsunami.
I've seen that.
And he talks about how there's an erosion. Whenever you have an island, there's always going to be erosion below the water surface of the base of that island. And at the same time, if it's a volcanic island, you have lava being built up from continual emissions from the volcano until the island becomes very high and top-heavy. and that's when it's vulnerable to... Hold on a second, please.
Yeah. We're talking about the mega tsunami that is expected when the side of the volcano in the Canary Islands collapses. That's okay.
Anyway, becomes top-heavy, and it's prone to collapsing into the ocean.
Right.
And that's how you get these mega, landslide-driven mega tsunamis. Incidentally, you know, I was watching the Science Channel, and they're talking about these kinds of events. And they happen to state that 4,000 years ago, the island of Reunion, is a French word, but it's actually spelled just like the word reunion. The island of Reunion off the coast of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean collapsed and caused a tremendous tsunami. The, you know, 4,000 years ago, well, look back, and when was the last passage of Planet X? Nearly 4,000 years ago, 36 and a half centuries. Now, their estimation of that collapse as being 4,000 years ago, that's a very rough estimation.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a more accurate estimation because we know what the orbital period of Planet X is. So we can pretty much assume that that collapse occurred due to the trauma to Planet Earth that was caused by Planet X around 1650 BC. In fact, we also have evidence from geologists that the great Santorini volcanic caldera in the Aegean Sea exploded around 1650 BC, 36 and a half centuries ago, due to the approach and the devastation, gravitational and magnetic devastation, exerted on Earth by this passing brown dwarf star.
So let me get this straight. All of these islands around the world that are prone to this type of activity where part of the landmass may slough off into the ocean, this could all happen in rapid succession around the world?
Probably will, not could, but probably will happen in rapid succession. Suppose you have, okay, let's say, suppose you have a tray of, it's loaded with these ice cream cones,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, and they're standing up on ice cream cone holders or whatever, and they're all triple-decker ice cream cones. And someone comes by and starts rattling that tray. All of them are going to start to topple over.
Right.
At the same time.
What about the glaciers and the ice packs in the Arctic and the Antarctic Ocean?
The trauma from this incoming planet, the just to see that alone, I mean, the lithospheric crust of the Earth that underlies at least the Antarctic, which is, you know, and the Arctic, too, because you have seabed, you have a seabed of crust in the Arctic region, too.
Mm-hmm.
As it begins to melt, it becomes more vulnerable to collapse. And as the seabeds begin to buckle due to the magma, the mantle becoming more fluid and heated up and becoming more active, churning more vigorously, then you have the crust beginning to bulge and buckle and move and shift, and that's when you're going to get all these collapses of ice shelves.
Right.
And it's been happening already.
No, I have another question, and this might be a dumb question. How much activity would it take to actually shift the poles, the pole shift that we hear about? Well, would this type of activity be enough to do that, having that much water and weight moving around the world all at the same time?
It definitely would, because we have ancient historical evidence that this has really happened. Like 1 year ago, when I was studying as a science for a science degree in education,
mm-hmm.
My geology professor stated, and I'll never forget this, he said, at one time in Earth's ancient history, Earth actually precessed on its axis,
right.
meaning it tilted vertically. And he said, we don't know why. Hold on a second, please.
Yeah.
And that always, you know, it was sort of appalling and curious to me, and I always kept that memory in my mind
mm-hmm.
because of the appalling nature of that statement. And now we know why. You see, what the scientists tell us to what Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky told us, he was one of the great land-breaking theoreticians who spoke about the catastrophic history of Earth, how Earth underwent its changes, not gradually as mainstream science had been telling us,
right.
but catastrophically in a very short period of time. And Velikovsky had explained how comets would come by, and it's like a, remember, there's a term in physics called action at a distance.
Right.
For example, if I take a strong magnet, lay it down on your kitchen table, and you put a ball bearing near the magnet, if you put it close enough, if it's within the gravity or the magnetic field of that magnetic influence of that magnet, the magnet will gradually cause the ball bearing to roll closer and closer, and as it rolls closer, the magnetic force between the magnet and the ball bearing will increase exponentially, really, as a function of distance. In other words, if the ball bearing gets one half of its original distance away, comes halfway toward the magnet, the magnetic force on that ball bearing does not double when the distance becomes half,
mm-hmm.
but the magnetic force actually quadruples, because so we see a force increasing as the inverse square of the distance between the attracting object and the attracted object. And that's what happens to Earth as this planet comes by. It's like a giant hand that a child's hands spinning a top with a spinning top. If the child brings the palm of his hand up against the side of a rapidly spinning top, the top slows down in its rotation, and when it does, it loses its force that keeps it straight up, and the top begins to wobble as it slows down. We've all seen that phenomenon.
Right.
And slower it gets, as it slows down more, it wobbles. The wobble becomes more accentuated, and eventually the top topples vertically, falls over. And that's what God is prophesying in the book of Isaiah chapter 24. In the King James Version, where there's a couple of mistranslations, I corrected it. Mistranslations by simply going to the Strong's Concordance of the Hebrew language, and I'll give you the actual words, two words, not removed and cottage, but nod like a hammock.
Mm-hmm.
I'll paraphrase Isaiah chapter 24. God says, I will cause the earth to reel to and fro like a drunkard, and to nod like a hammock. Now, if you were to take a model globe of the earth and put it in the bed of your backyard hammock and pull the hammock back in preparation to let it swing, what would happen to the north pole of that globe? It would rotate vertically toward the equator.
Right.
And the equator would similarly rotate vertically toward the south pole. So that's a nod. If you look up the word nod in a dictionary, it's a vertical rotation.
Right.
Like when you would nod to indicate yes. That's what God is saying. He says, I will cause, this was 600 B.C. when God, the mind of God spoke into the mind of Isaiah and compelled Isaiah to write this down. He says, the word of the Lord came to me. That's what Isaiah and Ezekiel and the other prophets always say. The word of the Lord came to me, and they wrote it down. God has that power to influence our minds. And he said, through Isaiah, I will cause the earth to reel to and fro like a drunkard, and to be removed, or to be to nod like a cottage, like to nod like a hammock, and it will fall and not recover.
Okay, so do have prophecy of that, of that actually happening.
Pardon me? The prophecy of, the prophecy has been made around 600 B.C.
Right.
And if you go to Isaiah chapter 13, I looked up the word, another word, they use the word, the English translators use the word removed again for planet Earth. God says, I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall be removed out of her place. Well, it's not the word removed. I corrected that translation by simply going, that mistranslation, by simply going to the Strong's Concordance of the Hebrew language. And God is actually saying, therefore I shall shake the heavens and cause the earth to undulate out of its place. Undulate is, you know, like a waving, bobbing motion, just same as
shaking,
reeling to and fro like a drunkard, or wobbling. So, and the outer planets have actually wobbled. So here's another answer to, I guess I'm making this long drawn out, but it's really worth the time and effort. We have seen the actual evidence of planets wobbling. The distant outer planets of Neptune actually wobbled. And that's been scientifically proven. Neptune went through a pole shift where it actually rotated vertically. It tilted vertically. There was a what's called a wizard's eye or a whirlpool on Neptune.
Right.
And that wizard's eye shifted vertically, which proved that Neptune went through a precessing of its axis. So it's already happened. Why? Because Planet X was out there exerting a gravitational influence on Neptune, which we have yet to see.
Right. And it's coming this way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
so,
you know what?
We've been on the air.
We've been on the air for 3 hours now, so we are going to wrap it up for the evening. I'm wondering, are you available to take to continue this next Saturday night?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
I'd be happy to help to bring this information to people who are going to need it.
Because we're really starting to get into the really good stuff now, so if we can take up from the pole shift aspect of it and get into the really scientific and prophetic sections of this, this would be, I think, really amazing for people.
Yeah, I mean, it would be wonderful for people to learn about this, and my main purpose is to get them to understand that we have our only hope eventually as these disasters build up and intensify. Our only hope is to turn to God in our hearts and our minds. In our comfort, the comfort of our world, we tend to be away, aloof from God. But now we have to start meditating, you know, getting our minds relaxed into a meditative state and just make ourselves consciously aware of the presence of God, and that's it, not to think any thought at all, just clear our minds of all thoughts, and just feel the presence of God as we're looking at some beautiful scenery around us, and
right. That's
what we have to do, to commune with God, and allow God to talk through us, to speak through us, to work His thoughts into us. It's all love. It's something that's going to be greatly beneficial to all of us. And suppose I were to die fat, dumb, and happy, and not experience these catastrophes, then I would die forever. I would never live again.
Right.
But this way, I will have an eternal life with God in a brand new, indestructible body, which He promises to give us in the Scriptures. Not an ethereal plasma, but an indestructible body for eternity in a new world, which we cannot conceive of.
Well, I think if everybody practices meditating this week and clearing their heads, I think that that might help us out next week when we talk about this.
Yes, right. That's a good idea. And I'm going to try to, you know, continue doing that myself. It's very difficult, but, you know, we get distracted. But
yeah,
I'm going to continue to do that, make that a part of my ongoing daytime activities.
Yeah, I try to do that at night before I go to sleep. Just try to clear my mind and make it blank.
Yeah, we've always all heard about the benefits of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's about time you started to experience those benefits.
I think so, too. Okay, folks, we are way past out of time. What we're going to do is we're going to transcode this, get this up on YouTube, and then we are going to repeat the show here on the stream so that you can listen to all 3+ hours of it continuously until Monday evening when we do our regular political talk show. And I'd like to thank our guest, John DiNardo, for coming on the show. And we're going to talk to you again next Saturday, and we'll set up a time for the broadcast whenever it's convenient for you. Okay, John?
Sure. Whenever I'm willing to appear with at your convenience, Bill.
Okay. Well.
So I know you're producing this, and it's going to be difficult. So I'll leave the timing to you.
Okay. We'll leave it at that then, and this show will repeat and. John and I will speak during the week, and we will set up next week's show, and you can come back to the main show page or check the YouTube channel. That'd be Sun Sky Mysteries channel on YouTube, and we will be talking again next week. John, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your hospitality, Bill.
Yes, yes. And have a good rest of the weekend.
Thank you. Same to you.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye, Bill.
And there we go, folks. That was John DiNardo. And we will go ahead and get busy on getting this rebroadcasting and getting this up on YouTube. I suspect I'm going to have to break this up into some substantially smaller portions so that we can actually get it up to uploaded to YouTube, and we will have this as an MP3 also for people to listen to at their leisure. And we will see everybody later. Thank you for showing up. We appreciate it. And until next time, this is Bill Zamm. Have a good evening and the rest of the weekend.